world stage. And Armenia Keir Starmer is trying to look like a statesman, talking security, stability, Britain's role in a more dangerous world, as the clouds, of course, darken domestically on his premiership back home. Meanwhile, Donald Trump is declaring what he's called a Freedom Day or Freedom Week in the Strait of Hormuz after US action to secure one of the most critical oil choke points on Earth. At the same time, as in a fit of pique, he's withdrawing 5,000 troops from Germany after the German Chancellor failed to back his ill-begotten war in Iran. A simple question. One of the hallmarks of the Starmer government has been its insistence there was no choice between America and Europe. Is Donald Trump making that decision for us?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, Sir Keir Starmer is due to tell European leaders that the UK is seeking closer ties with the EU to support Ukraine. The Prime Minister wants to join a multi-billion pound loan to ensure Kyiv gets the equipment it needs to fight Russia. He spoke to reporters before a meeting in Armenia this morning.
That is very good for Ukraine because it will give Ukraine capability that it desperately needs in year five of this conflict. It's very good for the UK because it'll be capability that leads to jobs in the United Kingdom. And it's very good for UK-EU relations, which is very important as we go on to the various discussions we're going to have today.
There are also reports this morning that the UK will be forced to pay £1 billion a year as part of a reset with Brussels. Three people have died from a suspected hantavirus outbreak on a cruise ship in the Atlantic. A British tourist is also being treated at a hospital in South Africa after falling ill. The disease is typically spread by rodents like rats and mice. Iran has threatened to attack US forces if they try to free ships stranded in the Strait of Hormuz. Donald Trump has offered support in what he called a humanitarian gesture as crews begin to run out of food. It's understood the US Navy would be on standby. Former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani has been described as a fighter after being taken to hospital. A spokesperson for the 81-year-old says he is in a critical but stable condition. And the NHS will begin rolling out a vaccine which can fight several types of cancer. The injection works by telling the body's immune system to recognise and kill cancer cells. Currently, patients have to spend long periods of time on a drip to get the drug. But Chief Nursing Officer at NHS England, Duncan Burton, has told LBC this would make a big difference.
To have this jab is a minute or a 2 minutes. So in total, you know, if you think about 10,000 patients receiving this treatment, that's about 100,000 hours of time that's saved every year, which is great for patients so they can get on with their lives, but also for staff, because it means we can treat and see more people and reduce those waiting times.
And we've just had a statement from Buckingham Palace saying that Princess Eugenie is expecting her third child with husband Jack Brooksbank this summer. We'll bring you more as we get it. LBC weather: showers for southern England, South Wales and northern Scotland. Brighter for southern Scotland, but mostly cloudy elsewhere. A high of 19 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Amelia Cox.
At John Lewis Money, we know your home is more than an address. It's the sunlight pouring in. Well, sometimes. The coffee on tap and the best spot on the sofa. It's why our home insurance is thoughtfully designed with three levels of flexible cover for the home you've created. Because when you notice the details, you notice the difference. Search John Lewis Money. Terms and exclusions apply. John Lewis Finance Limited is authorized for insurance distribution and credit broking by the Financial Conduct Authority.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Lewis Goodall.
Well, a very good morning to you. Monday, the 4th of May, bank holiday weekend, in case you haven't noticed, but not here, of course, on LBC, where the news never stops flowing and the politics never stops coming. Lewis Goodall sitting in for James O'Brien. This bank holiday Monday, and lots of hard politics, world politics to get through. There'll be lots of domestic politics this week, of course. We've got the local elections and national elections coming up on Thursday. I'm hosting the Election Night Show here on LBC, in case you hadn't already noticed, so I'll be back for that. But before then, lots of international news. In particular, we see, once again, from Iran, where Donald Trump sat in the White House day after day, getting more and more irate, throwing more and more tantrums about the fact that he started a war about which he does not know how to finish. And also at home, or at least in our home continent, it feels as if those tectonic plates are moving ever faster with regards to the US and European security. Let's start with Iran. Iran threatening this morning to attack US forces if they enter the Strait of Hormuz after Donald Trump said the US would help stranded ships out of the key waterway. Trump says the US military will start guiding stranded ships out of the strait from Monday morning Middle East time in a very long and even by his standards rambling Truth Social message. Some 20,000 mariners and 2,000 ships have been unable to leave the strait. Fascinating and pretty unpleasant subplot to all of this, to leave the strait since the US-Iran war began, and indeed they're running out of food and supplies. But the Iranian military insisting this morning that it will continue its dominance of the strait and that it will attack any foreign armed force that tries to enter, especially, quotes, the aggressive US army. This is Project Freedom from Donald Trump, describing it as a humanitarian gesture, adding, as I say, that many of the ships are running low on fuel. So we're going to talk about that a little bit. But also, this is all coming as European-US relations, never mind US-Iranian relations, continue to deteriorate. You may have seen over the course of the weekend Donald Trump announcing that he will withdraw 5,000 further American troops from Germany. Now, it is true to say that over the long term, Americans have been gradually reducing. The general trend, at least, has been to reduce its commitments in Central and Eastern Europe. Nonetheless, this is coming after Friedrich Merz, the German Chancellor, has earned the ire of Donald Trump for refusing to back his war in Iran. And we've seen the Prime Minister this morning in Yerevan, in Armenia, at a meeting of the European Political Community, yet another European acronym this, but it's a sort of loose, sort of, not even confederation really, but grouping of most European countries. It's not an EU deal, but an EU summit, but nonetheless European-wide. Keir Starmer has said that joining a £78 billion EU loan scheme to support Ukraine against Russia will be very good for relations between the EU and the UK, and create jobs in the UK. EU leaders met last month and approved the deal to lend Ukraine 90 billion euros over the next 2 years after the Hungarian government was replaced and finally agreed to the scheme. So Keir Starmer agreeing to take part, or wanting to take part, in this European scheme to help Ukraine. And this is apparently part, I think we can say with some confidence, part of a wider trend that Keir Starmer, and we're hearing very, very clearly from the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, who's described closer EU relations as the great economic and political prize. Keir Starmer saying things about the EU that he would not have said certainly 12 months or even 6 months, I think, ago, getting closer and closer and closer to the EU. And this being the latest example. I want to talk to you this morning about whether you think the Prime Minister, particularly in the moment he finds himself, ought to go further still in terms of relations with the EU, and perhaps even go beyond the red lines he has himself set for himself with regards to the single market, the customs union, and so on. Is it time that Donald Trump, as Donald Trump, is Donald Trump making the decision for us to get closer to the EU again, and perhaps even eventual readmission? 03456060973, 03456060973. Let's just listen to the Prime Minister this morning in Yerevan, talking about that deal.
We cannot deny that some of the alliances that we have come to rely on are not in the place we would want them to be. There is more tension in the alliances than there should be. And it's very important that we therefore face up to this as a group of countries together. At the tactical level, I think we've been pretty good. So on the coalition of the willing in relation to Ukraine, we've put together and sustained a group of countries around a single purpose, which is security guarantees for Ukraine. So a group of willing countries working together with a common purpose or a single purpose, where we've got the political alignment, but we've also got the military planning into quite an advanced place. That model is the one that we've borrowed into the Strait of Hormuz. Again, a group of willing countries, slightly different configuration, but with a single purpose.
So the Prime Minister there speaking in Yerevan in Armenia at that summit of the European political community. I think being more direct than I've ever heard him be on this question, I think he didn't name Trump specifically or the US specifically, but it's absolutely clear about whom and about which country he was talking. And when he said that we need to be honest with ourselves and straightforward, that our historic alliances aren't where they used to be and perhaps where they ought to be, it is clear that he's talking about Donald Trump. This is a man who, until not so long ago, the Prime Minister, was insisting, and indeed the pillar of his first year, and I'm not saying he was wrong to try to pursue this, by the way, but it is just a matter of fact, the pillar of his first year in terms of approaching his foreign policy was to say, in explicit terms, that others wished for to make the choice between the EU or between Europe and the United States. And that was no choice for Britain at all, he insisted. That is not the tone or indeed the substance that he is adopting and striking now. Being very clear and clear, as I say, than I think I've ever heard him be, the Prime Minister, basically admitting and accepting that the US-UK relationship, as we've hitherto known it, and the US-European relationship, as we've hitherto known it, is for the time being, at least, not there. Is the corollary for you, therefore, that actually we need to get closer to the EU? And what does that mean? And does that mean readmission? 03456060973. Let's turn first to Lord Peter Ricketts, former Permanent Secretary to the Foreign Office and UK National Security Advisor under David Cameron. Lord Ricketts, thanks so much for joining us this morning. Striking, I think, from the Prime Minister there in being so explicit in a way I certainly don't think I've, as I say, I've heard him be before.
Yeah, and he's right, Lewis, and your wrap-up is completely right. I think the balance has changed, even in the 18 months he's been in office. I mean, we've had Trump's behavior over Ukraine. We've had Trump's insulting, belittling Britain and the Europeans over Iran. I think the other alliance that Keir Starmer is talking about is NATO. I mean, NATO has been very badly damaged by the way Trump has behaved in the last year or so. And so it is becoming clearer that we cannot simply carry on putting all our security eggs in the NATO basket. And the fact he's with a group of, I think it's around 40 European countries in Yerevan. This is a wider European collection, not just the EU. It's part of this variable geometry European groupings that are developing outside NATO. And the one thing they all have in common is that the US isn't in them. So this is variable ways in which the Europeans are getting together to lead on Ukraine, take action possibly on the Strait of Hormuz. And now more broadly, Keir Starmer is casting his net, talking about this as a structure for thinking about Europe's security as America pulls back. So yes, the balance has shifted. He's not saying, I think, that we need to cut our ties with NATO or with the US. We can't do that. The fact is we're still very, very dependent on them for a lot of our defense and intelligence cooperation. But the balance has shifted. Donald Trump doesn't care at all for alliances, and we've got to adjust to take that into account.
Do you agree with the summation of the Polish government over the weekend when they suggested that NATO is disintegrating?
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I mean, I think it's possible that NATO can survive this. I mean, with a future US president, NATO is, after all, a big structure, 10,000 people, military, civilian commands. I mean, if it collapsed, it would be very hard to build something back in its place. But we've got to make it a more European NATO, certainly. And we've got to make do with less American personnel, less American commanders, less American kit in Europe. The trick, I think, is to try and make sure they don't pull it down so fast. We haven't got time to build up a European substitute.
The Trump announcement over the weekend that he was going to withdraw 5,000 US personnel from Germany, apparently in reaction to the worsening relations between Friedrich Merz and Trump over Iran. How significant do you think that is?
Well, that sounds like a kind of an angry reaction to Merz's comments. I think actually the Pentagon's been planning for some time to take Americans out of Europe. But it seems to me actually that the Americans have had troops here because it's in their interest. You know, they've been using the Ramstein Air Base in Germany and others as part of their resupply into the Gulf region. It is in American interest to have their forces here. They cannot clearly do without with fewer if they choose to do that. The way he announced it made it sound like a kind of angry spat with Merz rather than a strategic decision that was in American interests. And I think it's drawn a lot of criticism, including from Republicans in Congress. So this is not by any means a unanimously popular approach he's taking.
What do you make of the Prime Minister's idea to apply to take part in the EU-Ukraine loan scheme? Do you think that that's a good idea?
Yes, I do. I mean, I think that was always the idea from the beginning, that the British, who can add something to this loan but can't match anything like the 90 billion euros that the European Union can amass, by adding ours to theirs, it increases the size of the package. We've been a very strong supporter of Ukraine from the outset. Interesting, the Prime Minister casts it as good for British jobs, because, of course, this loan to the Ukrainians will be spent by the Ukrainians, quite a lot of it, on buying European military equipment, if they're not allowed to buy American. So it does have a potential positive impact on British jobs. But the essential thing is it's showing solidarity with Ukraine. And as he said, it is another way of Britain showing that it is useful, it works with the European Union, we have similar interests. We tried, listeners will remember, to get into the so-called Safe Defence Investment Fund that the EU set up, $150 billion there. And there they slammed the door in our face with a ridiculous demand for several billion pounds of entry fee. This loan agreement is different. I think the UK can just simply add our funds to the European funds. But it shows that it's another way of Keir Starmer profiling that he is wanting to work ever more closely with the European Union.
Although, I mean, the Times, I know today, is reporting that Brussels is telling Starmer that Britain will have to make annual payments into European budgets for the first time since Brexit as part of the Prime Minister's reset. European negotiators making it clear that paying the cash, expecting to amount to about $1 billion a year, is a condition of further access to the EU's single market. I am somewhat reminded of that period during the Brexit negotiations when you could sometimes feel that the EU sometimes failed to see the wood for the trees and would lose sight of the wider strategic objective, because for the sake of £1 billion or so into the budget, if that makes Starmer's life more difficult in terms of actually realigning with the bloc, surely that's got to be the prize rather than what is, for European terms, a trifling amount of money.
Well, I'm afraid you're right. I mean, I think that Brussels bureaucracy, they have a rule book. They read in the rule book, it says if you are going to have countries joining sectors of the single market, they have to pay into what the EU call cohesion funds. In other words, funding for the poorer regions. Just to unpack that a little bit, there was agreement that we would rejoin, we'd get rid of the plant and animal health checks, and we would rejoin the emissions trading system. That was in the last summit, and no payments being required of us for that. If we're going to rejoin other parts of the single market, which is what Rachel Reeves has been talking about, the EU has been saying, yes, then you're going to have to pay into the budget to help weaker members of the single market. That's what the Norwegians do. That's what the Swiss do. I mean, but your big point is right. With war in Europe and with America-US relations very rocky, to insist on the fine detail of how we access the single market and effectively raise barriers, which it's going to be politically very difficult for the Brits to get over, that does seem to be very short-sighted. And there must be a better way of getting UK closer to the EU than this very transactional, slightly protectionist approach that is absolutely integral to Brussels' way of thinking.
Do you think the politics of this does appear to be moving quite quickly. Do you think that it could move sufficiently quickly that our membership, certainly of any of the key institutions, customs union, the single market, maybe even the bloc itself, might come back on the horizon?
I mean, I think it comes back on the horizon, Lewis, but I think it's still a little way away. I mean, for a start, the EU would have to calculate, you know, is this country that suddenly decided to leave the EU now, has it really changed? Can we now rely on a stable UK consensus that they want to rejoin the EU? I mean, I certainly don't think they'd be interested in talking about that till after a next British election that produced a pro-European government. At that point, then I think they would be interested. It will be interesting to see whether any of the major parties campaign for the next election on a platform that talks about, you know, rejoining the single market, for example, if elected. That would be the game changer. The customs union doesn't really do much for the economic impact. If you rejoin the single market, that would be a big economic boost. Clearly, you'd have to have a clear platform for that. But Brussels wouldn't be interested unless they knew that another election had passed and a pro-European government had been returned to Westminster. So we are still several years away from that, in my view.
And just finally, briefly, Laura Kitts, if you would, this plan to get ships, stranded ships, out of the strait, Iran saying that they will target any foreign ship that goes into it. I mean, is it militarily, do you think, possible to do what Trump is saying?
And I wish I knew what Trump was saying he was going to do, because as you said at the beginning, you know, he used that word guiding. We're going to guide ships. He's not committing that US warships will go through the strait with these vessels, I don't think. And so I think it puts ship owners in an impossible position. They've got the Americans saying on one side, go for it, we'll guide you. We've got the Iranians saying on the other side, if the Americans come anywhere near us, we'll attack them. What are the poor ship owners supposed to decide in that? It sounds to me like they're going to be very doubtful. Maybe one or two will try it. Maybe you know the Iranians will do some kind of token action against a ship to try and frighten everybody off again. Sounds to me like it's going to be basically a continuation of the stalemate. But Trump trying to position himself as the big humanitarian leader, trying to help out the poor stranded seafarers in the Gulf. But unless he's absolutely clear that they will get American military protection, I don't think many of them will risk it.
Lord Ricketts, Lord Peter Ricketts there, former Undersecretary at the Foreign and Commonwealth Office and National Security Advisor back in David Cameron's government. Very, very simple question here. Is the politics moving sufficiently quickly that Keir Starmer will be and ought to be in a position where he actually puts EU membership back on the table or something close to it? Is that something that is at this point desirable for the UK? Or, as Lord Ricketts says, frankly, would the EU even want us? 0345 6060973. We'll be speaking to the Minister for EU-UK Relations. That is coming up a little bit later on this hour. Lewis Cuddle sitting in for James O'Brien here on LBC. The time is 10:20.
LBC.
Join us this spring at ABBA Voyage. The groundbreaking concert like no other. And dance along to some of the band's most popular hits. Only at London's ABBA Arena. New dates on sale. Book now at abbavoyage.com.
Quick voice note, still at the bakery. Big order just came in. Is anyone free to do the school run?
Yeah, I'm free. I could pick her up.
Oh, you're a star.
No worries. Just to say, I do accept payment in cupcakes.
We're here to keep your business connected with the people that matter most. That's why we're happy to be your second most important network. Tesco Mobile for Business. It pays to be connected. Find out more at tescomobile.com/business.
Your skin looks beaut. Did you buy that fancy cleanser?
Actually, I've been using the Bee Melting Cleansing Balm from Superdrug. It literally removes all my makeup. So impressed with it.
Nice. I always worry about trying new products.
Same, but Superdrug's own brand skincare has a money-back guarantee.
So good. Defo stopping at Superdrug on the way home. Superdrug own brand skincare. See results or your money back.
Keep receipt for refund of purchase price. Fair use policy applies. Guarantee is in addition to statutory rights, which remain unaffected. Visit superdrug.com/moneyback for full T's and C's.
Hear that? It's your big McDonald's hunger calling. And that's not just any kind of hunger. It's the kind that calls for the Big Arch. Stacked with juicy beef, cheddar cheese and that Big Arch sauce. Oh, and don't forget those crispy onions. Hungry? You are now. Serve from 11 a.m. subject to availability. Price and participation may vary.
I'm Will Buxton.
I'm Naomi Schiff.
I'm David Coulthard.
And I'm Joni Shaw.
This is Up to Speed. Available every Monday and Thursday on Global Player or wherever you get your podcasts.
Radio.
Lewis Goodall on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
Time is just about to turn 10:23. We're talking about whether Donald Trump is and has, by, for all intents and purposes, made the choice for us between Europe and the UK and the US. And whether or not in his actions and the fact that the Prime Minister, I mean, as I say, that clip we heard of him speaking in Yerevan, very, very striking. Just how explicit he has been today in a way that I think would have been inconceivable. I think even 6 months, 3 months ago, basically saying that the US-UK alliance, as we've known it, European-US alliance, is not what it once was, not likely to return to where it had been anytime soon. And therefore, we have to rethink. And inexorably, inevitably, does it not, does that lead us to Europe? But then the second question is, what does that mean? Is it the EU? Is it something else? Would the EU even want us back? 0345 6060973. You can WhatsApp on the same number, of course, as well. I've got a good text here. So if I remember correctly, Lewis, Andrew says, you are a Trekkie. Through that lens, is America becoming the Ferengi and Trump the Grand Nagus? If you know, you know. Claire is in Edgware. Claire, good morning.
Yes, good morning. Lovely to have you substituting for James.
Oh, well, bless
you're an outstanding,
thank you.
Not substitute, but stand-in. I don't want to really get you to substitute.
I am very happy either way. That's very kind of you, Claire. Thank you.
Indeed. Well, it just shows what an outstanding leader Keir Starmer is, and it would be suicidal to replace him at this critical time in our security. Joining this fund to defend Ukraine is an outstanding idea. Although I'm somewhat of a pacifist, I'm also a realist, and I know that any money that we put into this fund will end up benefiting our arms industry, because we will supply the munitions that they need that America is refusing to. And also I read that the fund is going to be backed by confiscated Russian funds. So I don't believe, and I don't think, Ukraine should repay the money. They're defending Eastern Europe against this genocidal lunatic who, when he's finished with the Ukraine, will go into Poland. And what's next? They've held the lines. They've kept Russia back for, what, about 5 years? And they should be commended for doing that. And we should give them all our support. And with regard to the single market, of course, incremental steps to go in. We were growing at 0.5% before the US-Israel stupid, murderous, genocidal war that Iran was always going to win. There was never any question of that. So we should take incremental steps towards the single market. We should most definitely support Ukraine, and we should join this fund.
Do you think, Claire, that if we... The Starmer, in terms of, has signalled that we should be getting closer back to the EU. If this is about security and our defence, is the EU really the appropriate body and forum? Because the EU is fundamentally a political, economic organisation. It's not a defence one.
Well, no, I don't think we should relegate NATO to sort of something that's inconsequential that we're about to leave, because we will never leave NATO. But the remember, it's not necessarily America, it's Trump. Trump has thrown a strop because we didn't join his stupid illegal war. NATO is a defensive organisation, and I think it's crucial to our defence. But we must not just be in one, put all our eggs in one basket. We must diverge and unify with Europe, and also have a defence which is beneficial to Europe, and then as a result beneficial to us. So I don't see why we can't do the two in tandem. We don't need to leave NATO, but we need to be realistic. NATO is, what, an 80-year-old organisation that may be coming to something of an evolution in its own life. But we must look towards Europe, because basically we're Europeans. We need to move closer to Europe. There's always strength in unity. There's always strength in numbers. And I believe because Spain and Italy, and well, not necessarily Italy, but certainly Spain stood with us against this illegal war in Iran, that we were stronger for it. And I just think we should all stand together as a country. We are, we're not actually at war, but we're facing the effects of this stupid war. And we must stand together with Europe.
Claire, in Edgware there, grateful to you. I mean, there is one thing to say that I sometimes... I sometimes wish those who had advocated Brexit would engage with. And don't get me wrong, my feelings about this are not uncomplicated. I think it would be extremely difficult and potentially actually undesirable to go back into the EU. Certainly right now, I don't think our domestic politics is where it would need to be. I don't think the EU would want us. I think they wouldn't give us back the rebate. They wouldn't give us a Schengen exemption. They wouldn't give us the great deal, to be honest, that we had before. That wouldn't be available. So you'd be ending up in a sort of second best option, which is a difficult sell politically. But I also think that there is a question. What I do wish that those who had advocated Brexit nonetheless would engage with, though, is the fact that when we did Brexit, the world was so different. It was so different. It was basically a bet Brexit on unalloyed free trade, on the idea that there would be further globalization, economic strengthening of cooperation and ties around the world, that there wasn't going to be protectionism, there wasn't going to be nativism, there wasn't going to be nationalism, there wasn't going to be populism. And there wasn't going to be, even though the Crimean invasion had taken place, there wasn't going to be a massive, huge security threat to most of Europe, to Europe's east. And yet that is precisely the world, the protectionist, nativist, nationalist, populist world with that Russian threat that we find ourselves in. And Britain, at the same time, decided to dismantle the fundamental pillars, or one of the fundamental pillars, of its foreign policy, which has left us, whatever other benefits of Brexit there may otherwise be, politically adrift. And yet we wouldn't, from the advocates of Brexit, know it. because there has absolutely been no self-reflection on that question at all. And the fact that we have basically entered a massive geopolitical experiment at precisely the moment that the whole pieces of the geopolitical order have been thrown up into the air and in flux again. Kerry is in Shetland. Kerry.
Good morning, Lewis. Lovely to speak to you. Ever since Trump has been on the throne, I put it on the throne in the US of A.
Well, it would be a gold throne, wouldn't it? We know that for an absolute fact.
He probably has got a gold throne somewhere. But
his toilet, perhaps.
Maybe so. But ever since he started doing what he's been doing against Europe, and especially the tariffs, and also after Greenland and saying that he's going to invade Cuba, etc., I'm hardly surprised that we in Europe have said, sorry, Mr. Trump, we don't need you really anymore. And his acronym used to be TACO, Trump Always Chickens Out. But now he's got a new acronym, which is NACHO, N-A-C-H-O, Not a Chance or Mose Opens. And I think what we ought to do,
Let's see if that catches on.
It already has. And I think what we ought to do is Starmer needs to become transactional, a bit like Trump in a way. Because when Trump bombed Iran, he never told anyone he was going to do that. He never told, only the Israelis knew, and never told us a thing. And I think what we ought to do is we ought to become very transactional. Mm. And because he's made such a mess in the Persian Gulf...
But what do we have to transact with, Kerry? What do we have to transact with?
Well, what we ought to do is say to him, right, we'll go and fix up your mess. And we'll talk and we'll get Spain involved, Germany perhaps, and definitely France, and maybe Italy. We'll send our forces down there to sort out his mess. And we'll send him a bill... For his stupidity, because I think in a transactional sense, he might understand where we're coming from.
The thing is, we don't have the capability, though, do we, Kerry? Even if we wanted to do that, we don't really have the military capability to it. We certainly don't have the... If the full might of the US military, which remains the most powerful military on the face of the planet, if they can't sort out and free the straits, or the Strait of Hormuz, then we don't have a hope.
Well, we do have the ability to be diplomatic to other countries, and I think we could be far more diplomatic with Iran than America ever will be or ever might be in the future. And I think that we ought to send them a bill for sending off our diplomats to Iran to have a good chat with them, trying to get the Strait of Hormuz open at least. And I think it's such an idea that we ought to forward that certainly to Starmer and to the whole of Europe.
Kerry, grateful to you. Kerry in Shetland there. I've got a text here from James. Presumably not that James. He says, Lewis, just to lighten the mood a tiny bit, can you have one of your excellent Trump impressions before the 11 o'clock juncture, please?
No, absolutely not. But it is time now for the news at 10:32 with Amelia Cox.
The Prime Minister is in Armenia to discuss a multi-billion pound loan for Ukraine. Sir Starmer says joining the initiative will be very good for closer ties between the UK and Europe. A 69-year-old British man is in hospital in South Africa following an outbreak on a cruise ship. Three people have already died from the spread of hantavirus on the MV Hondius. And Princess Eugenie is pregnant with her third child with her husband Jack Brooksbank. Buckingham Palace says the King, her uncle, is delighted with the news, and their two elder sons, August and Ernest, are very excited. LBC weather, showers for southern England, south Wales and northern Scotland. Brighter for southern Scotland, but mostly cloudy elsewhere. A high of 19 degrees.
This is LBC.
People ask me, what's my good place? Wild swimming with the girls on a chilly spring morning. And knowing that with PensionBee, I can choose to invest in line with my values, which is why I picked their climate plan.
Last one in by blood!
At PensionBee, we believe that when your pension is in a good place, you're in a good place. Download the app or go to pensionbee.com and be pension confident when investing your capital is at risk.
There's one green bottle sat on my fridge shelf. This green and white bottle that supports my gut health. Beautiful by nature, biotiful by name. It's the tastiest way to up my gut health game.
Biotiful gut health. Switch your yogurt to the UK's number one kefir and give your gut and your summer a lift. Kefir is a source of calcium which contributes to the normal function of digestive enzymes. For verification of UK's number one kefir, see biotifulguthealth.com/radio.
This year at Amazon, we're increasing the electric vehicles used for deliveries across Europe to over 10,000. It's a difference you'll notice on your doorstep, where babies are made a fuss of, where we deliver footballs for kids' kickabouts, and where they deliver the football straight into next door's garden. Can they have their ball back, please? We're delivering change where it matters, on your doorstep. Based on projected delivery service partner vehicles across the UK and EU by end of 2026.
Train to Cambridge and then all aboard the paddleboards. A little bit different, should be fun.
Or wobbly, or wet.
The wetsuit's a good look on you, Steve.
Oh, actually, this is very relaxing.
George is up the river cam without a paddle.
Train home, that was such a laugh. I think I might even have a new hobby.
Download the Thameslink Railway app to book advanced single tickets from London St Pancras to Cambridge from only £11. Thameslink Railway, where every stop is a story. Terms apply.
Lewis Goodall on LBC. Text 84850.
Time is 10:35. We're talking about this quite explicit statement that Keir Starmer, not explicit in that way, obviously. He's not gone completely mad. We'll leave that for Friday. Keir Starmer has made about the EU and about, well, not about the US, and about the fact that EU and European-US relations, UK-US relations, are clearly not what they once were, and we cannot rely on those old alliances. A sea change in where he was 12 months, 6 months, maybe even 3 months ago. That is how fast things are moving. What might be possible if by that the Prime Minister means that we ought to get closer to the EU, something he has been talking about for a long time. The Chancellor again has been more and more explicit about this, saying that closer EU-UK economic relations are the prize of the reset that the government has engaged on in terms of that relationship. What might be possible in terms of the realpolitik? What might the EU, because so often in this country we just talk as if we are the only player, the only people engaged in this dance, whereas of course the EU have to take part too and have to want it as well. What might be possible from their point of view? Well, Anand Menon, Professor of European Politics and Foreign Affairs at King's College, joins us now. Also, of course, Director of UK and a Changing Europe. Anand, thanks so much for joining us this morning. The EU, as I say, we often talk as if they don't have their own wants and their own ass and their desires, but as you and I both remember all too well from the Brexit process, that is far from the case. What mood and appetite, if we've had this change of heart, or at least our government appears to be having one quite quickly, is the EU having one as well? And what might be available to us that might not have been available in the sort of dog days of the Theresa May period when she was trying to negotiate Brexit?
Well, I suppose the answer is to that is yes and no, in the sense that there is certainly a feeling among national capitals in the European Union that they need to work with the United Kingdom. We face shared security threats. What's going on in Ukraine, what's going on in the Gulf means that we have to work together more closely. The problem comes where that's translated into what the EU negotiates with us, because there is a very zero-sum attitude that the EU will obviously negotiate with us, but they'll only give us things that they think are in their own interest. So sometimes there is a gap between those broader security aspirations and the detailed negotiations where the EU plays hardball and actually insists on quite often either large sums of money or other concessions from us, which led to, for instance, the breakdown of talks over cooperation over defence procurement about a year ago.
Well, I note as well, and I put this to Lord Ricketts earlier, I note that the EU in some ways, perhaps quite frustratingly, it always is this kind of quite mechanistic organisation, quite formalised organisation. I note the Times reporting that if we do want to have this reset and get greater access to the single market, then they will expect us to pay into the European budget. And, of course, we know how potentially politically noxious that will be or could be for Keir Starmer in the UK. Fundamentally, in some ways, the EU doesn't change. It doesn't sort of see sometimes a sort of wider strategic prize and instead insists on the application to the letter when it suits them of their own rules. And that's one of the problems in dealing with it.
No, absolutely. And the irony is the Eurosceptics are right. The European Union is a legalistic, bureaucratic body, and that's how it negotiates. And there are two things we in the UK need to bear in mind. The first is we are no longer a priority for them, so actually getting their attention is quite difficult. And secondly, they're relatively happy with the trade deal as it exists. So if they're going to make changes to that trade deal, we need to give them an incentive to want to.
What incentives might those be? What cards might the Prime Minister... God, I really feel like it is 2018 all over again. What cards might the Prime Minister have to deploy?
Well, there is a sense of deja vu about this. I suppose two main cards at the moment in terms of where we are. The first is the European Union's really keen on a deal on youth mobility to allow young people to travel and work and study more easily. The sticking point there, or one of the sticking points, is the EU wants us to allow their students to come to the UK and pay domestic fees to our universities. Now, that will have big financial implications for universities. The other possible way of unlocking the talks is cash. The EU, for instance, have said that if we want to integrate back into their electricity market, which we're currently talking about, we will have to pay into their cohesion fund. There's a story in the newspapers today saying if we want further integration in further sectors, that could cost us up to £1 billion. So the EU will take money in a sort of pay-for-play deal. But of course, even then, all the member states have to agree. And all it takes is one member state who thinks, well, actually, our companies are doing quite well with the UK pushed out of this market. Our companies are taking the place of their companies. And that member state can veto everything.
And I suppose as well, in terms of anything deeper, particularly rejoining some of the sort of the structures of the EU, whether it's the single market, customs union, perhaps even the bloc itself, I suppose the truth is that the EU would have to be pretty convinced that a political consensus had been reached in the UK about longer term reattachment to the EU, which quite frankly they can certainly see right now does not exist.
Oh, I'm sure. And I'm sure that in any deal we have, whether it's sectoral or broader, they will want to have backstops, so to speak, in place to prevent us sort of reneging.
Stop talking about backstops. Now, this is 2018. You talking about backstops. It's one for the geeks.
You know, I remember a few months ago, I think it was the I newspaper reporting that the EU were in favour of having what they called a Farage clause, which meant that if we decided to change our minds, there would be penalties involved. So, yes, obviously they're thinking about that. At the same time, you know, they have to negotiate with the government they have now, and they're willing to do so, but they will, as I said, strike a hard bargain.
Professor Anand Menon there, Professor of European Politics at King's College. Let's talk to Mark, who, well, is unliterally, in a sense, on the front line of the geopolitics of this, because he's in Kharkiv in Ukraine. Mark, good morning, or good afternoon, where you are.
Good morning to you. Well, it's good afternoon.
Indeed,
a beautiful sunny day here. Beautiful sunny day.
A very cloudy day in London, so there you go.
Oh, well, never mind. Never sometimes mind. We get the sun and sometimes we don't. But yeah, I was just listening to your previous caller, by the way. It's, I don't know what he did his professorship, but, you know, from a European perspective, the net gain way outweighs any loss, any 1 billion. The amount of revenue that we've lost as a country, the UK, since Brexit is staggering. You know, but anyway, that's another conversation. So, my sort of perspective, I listened to the news this morning, actually to LBC, and I was listening to Starmer's proposal with this £79 billion fund, and I think it's wonderful. It's if we can piggyback on the back of that and help us over here, because we do need help. We're winning this war, but it's very slow, and it's very arduous, and it's going to last at least another 3 years. So if a £79 billion loan becomes available to the Ukrainians, that can only do good.
And what takes you to Kharkiv, Mark?
I work for an NGO here. I come here two or three times a year. I'm here for 2 months now until the end of July. Then I come back in September and I'll be here for a year.
And give us a sense of what the mood is there at the moment.
Very, very positive. The Ukrainians are tough cookies. Kharkiv is...
Say that again.
Not that far from the Russian... The tough cookies. Kharkiv is not that far away from the front line here. Yeah. I mean, we get bombed every day. But you become very philosophical and immune to it. You ignore it, which you shouldn't do, really, because it's quite dangerous.
Yes.
But the Kharkivians and the Ukrainians have a resilience that I've never seen anywhere else. It's wonderful. You know, the kids go to school, the shops are open. I'm just outside a jazz bar right now because I've just finished work. And the spirit, these guys are going to win this. It's going to take time, but they are going to win. This is the front line to Europe.
Mm.
You know, this is what's keeping the Russians out of the Baltic states,
absolutely,
this war.
The Ukrainians have been doing our dirty work for the past four years.
4 years, yeah. It's fifth year we're coming into now, yeah, which is almost longer than the Second World War.
Yeah, it's already surpassed the First World War. It's absolutely extraordinary. And you're saying,
yeah,
you think it'll last for another three. I mean, it is true to say, I mean, it's not actually got as much coverage. If you go back about 12 months ago, or certainly 9 months ago, when Trump was trying to basically pressure the Ukrainians to sign a kind of white peace with Putin, The premise of it was to say, well, you're losing this war, you're not going to win this war, Putin's, you know, throwing hundreds of thousands of men and endless amounts of and munitions at you, that's not going to stop. Actually, it's not got as much coverage as it should, but you've alluded to it, Mark. Ukraine's actually been on the advance in a lot of places and has been certainly, at the very least, completely holding the Russians back.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We can hear the fronts. If the wind's blowing in the right direction. Don't get me wrong, I'm not in the front. I work in the city. I'm far too old to go in places where bombs and bullets fly. But they're magnificent. It's unbelievable, these people, what they're doing. Now, people are going to say, oh, well, there's corruption and this. Well, you know what? There is. There's no question about that. There are certain elements over here that you say, you give a sort of a shady look at. Because of what goes on. But I suppose that's the same in any war. There is always a darker underbelly, but it's not that deep and it's not that great.
And I know, well, of course, that President Zelensky has called on the UK to rejoin the EU, as has Peter Megyar, the new Prime Minister of Hungary.
Yeah. And I think we will eventually, probably not in my lifetime, in truth, almost certainly in yours, because it can only be a good thing. And there will be a bill to pay. But the upside benefits way outweigh that bill.
Mark, in Kharkiv, really grateful for your perspective in such a, if I can use this in the loosest term of the world, fascinating part of the world right now. A text here from Ron, who says, Lewis, please explain the term single market and customs union. Unless LBC does this, these discussions have very little substance. Well, a little bit of public service broadcasting, Ron. I'm more than happy to oblige. Single market basically means that countries agree to remove barriers so goods, services, money and people can move about freely. That basically means having the same regulatory standards to make it as easy in regulation terms to export something from Lisbon to Lublin as it would if you were just sort of moving it around Portugal or just moving it around France or anything like that. The customs union is about trade at the border. And members of a customs union agree not to charge tariffs, i.e. taxes, on each other's goods at the border and to apply the same tariffs to countries outside of the bloc. Don't let it ever be said we don't teach you anything here at LBC. 1046.
LBC. Time to bring your out-of-date kitchen up to date. Wix has over 80 kitchen styles so you can find the perfect one. Book your free kitchen design appointment at Wix.
Have you spotted anything?
Only seagulls. Are you sure this beach is a nature reserve?
Well, the sign said nature this way. Hey, what's that big bird over there? Flapping its wings, unusual markings.
You sure that sign didn't say naturists?
Oi, this is a nudist beach.
Ooh. Now, where are my binoculars?
Cheryl?
Struggling to read in the sun? Get 2-for-1 at Specsavers and make prescription sunglasses your second pair. From £70 with standard single vision lenses to the same prescription. Terms and conditions apply. See in store for details.
Now, focus on your car. That's right. The one you're ready to sell. See it clearly in your mind, waiting to be sold. We can make it disappear. Just watch carefully. Your car, sold, collected and paid for in almost no time at all. It's not magic, it's Motorway. Sell your car today at motorway.co.uk.
Listeners, we interrupt the airwaves to share an incredible discovery. The reason why Britain hasn't been so great of late is because the country hasn't been eating enough Weetabix. We must get to work in rebuilding Great Britain, Bix by Bix. By delivering Weetabix to whoever plans the traffic diversions, to delivery drivers who can't seem to find your house, and people who don't stack the dishwasher properly. To Britain, we must say, have you had your Weetabix?
The quintessential Mackey's burger, the go-to you'll always go to.
The new cheese and bacon McCrispy. 100% chicken breast, melty cheese, sizzling bacon. Betray your go-to for the new cheese and bacon McCrispy. Now at McDonald's. Served from 11 a.m. Subject to availability.
Leading Britain's conversation, LBC, with Lewis Goodall.
Time is 10:48. Let's just remind ourselves, we're going to be talking to Nick Thomas-Simmons, who's the minister in charge of EU-UK relations. Let's just remind ourselves, I think it is an important moment, of what the Prime Minister has said speaking in Armenia at the European Political Community Conference.
We cannot deny that some of the alliances that we have come to rely on are not in the place we would want them to be. There is more tension in the alliances than there should be. And it's very important that we therefore face up to this as a group of countries together. At the tactical level, I think we've been pretty good. So on the coalition of the willing in relation to Ukraine, we've put together and sustained a group of countries around a single purpose, which is security guarantees for Ukraine. So a group of willing countries working together with a common purpose or a single purpose, where we've got the political alignment, but we've also got the military planning into quite an advanced place. That model is the one that we've borrowed into the Strait of Hormuz. Again, a group of willing countries, slightly different configuration, but with a single purpose.
So that's the Prime Minister speaking in Yerevan at the EPC summit. Well, let's turn now to Nick Thomas-Simmons, who is the Minister for the Constitution, also Minister in charge of the UK-EU Relations Reset, Paymaster General as well. Nick Thomas-Simmons, thanks so much for joining us this morning, or this afternoon, where you are in Armenia. The Prime Minister saying there that there are certain old alliances which can no longer be relied upon. I assume he's talking about the United States.
First of all, Lewis, it's a real pleasure to join you, yes, from Yerevan here in Armenia. And look, I think the transatlantic relationship is and will remain critical for us in defence and security terms. But there's no doubt, and I think this is what the Prime Minister was referring to, that there has been change. And one example of that is obviously in terms of the burden of defence spending changing within NATO. NATO remains the cornerstone of our security policy, but it is absolutely the case that Europe as a continent now, the EU and European states more widely, that's what the European political community is all about. You know, well over 40 European countries represented here today. And one of the things, Lewis, that we've agreed here at this summit is that the EU is open to UK participation in the Ukraine loan scheme. And what that means is it's going to be about, of course, more support, essential military support for Ukraine, which can be good for Ukraine, good for jobs, and good for the UK-EU relationship as well.
Would you agree with the diagnosis of the Polish government over the course of the weekend, who said that, in their view, NATO is disintegrating?
No, I don't agree that. I think that NATO is and remains absolutely central to our security. But as I said, Lewis, there is undoubtedly a change within NATO in terms of that burden of defence spending. It's absolutely critical that the UK is leading in that. We are leading in that, whether it's here at the European Political Community Summit, the coalition of the willing with regard to Ukraine, and stepping up on defence spending as well.
Can we rely on Donald Trump?
Yes, and I say that, Lewis, from a point of view of working as I do as a minister in the Cabinet Office. And I see across government every day, US and indeed UK armed forces working together in military bases across the world. There is a depth and a breadth to the intelligence and security relationship that is working extremely well and is working week by week.
But that's not quite the same thing, Minister. I understand that at official level there's a depth of relationship, but I'm just wondering specifically in terms of Donald Trump, who is withdrawing 5,000 troops from Germany, apparently irritated by what Chancellor Merz has said about Iran. I'm wondering, can we rely on him personally? I assume that's what the Prime Minister is saying when he says that there are old alliances which cannot no longer be relied upon.
No, it's not about that.
And what's he saying then?
We, of course, have had issues where we've been in a different position from the President of the United States. Indeed, the offensive war in Iran, where the Prime Minister took a, by the way, courageous decision not to get involved in that when both Kemi Badenoch and Nigel Farage would have done. But, of course, it remains a reliable relationship. But this is a different context, Lewis. The world context is different. We live in a more dangerous world where it is unquestionably the case, this is one of the reasons I'm here at the summit, where a closer UK-EU relationship is in our national interest, whether it's for prosperity, safety of our citizens, but also for security too.
In terms of the Ukraine loan scheme, the amount of money that Britain might loan to Ukraine. Is that fixed or might it go up over time?
So we're very confident it'll be funded from the UK's money that we've already ring-fenced for Ukraine, which is £3 billion a year. But the way this is going to work is the UK will make a fair contribution to the cost of providing the loan within the EU budget. And it will be proportionate. In other words, it'll be linked to the value of contracts sold to Ukraine by UK defence suppliers. And this is the principle I've always acted upon, Lewis, in terms of financial contributions. It has to be value for money for the UK taxpayer and in our national interest. And absolutely my belief is that the Ukraine loan scheme fits into those categories.
We're seeing in terms of the wider reset that you've been responsible for, you've been leading on that effort. We had the sort of first stage of that. We've heard the Chancellor talking about the prize being greater economic or strengthening of economic relations with the EU. Over and above what you have already secured, and I assume your red lines in terms of single market and customs union are still in place, over and above what you've already secured, what would a deepening of the UK-EU relationship look like?
So first of all, Lewis, as you say, we want to deliver by the next summit the food and drink agreement to bear down on prices in our supermarket, price the weekly shop. We want to link our emissions trading systems and work together on, yes, decarbonisation, cheaper path to net zero, but also trying to bear down energy prices, and also, very exciting in my view, a youth experience scheme for opportunities for young Brits. Beyond that, you're absolutely right to challenge me on it. What we have said is we will now be looking at other sectors, other parts of the single market across government, going through a process of looking where it is in our sovereign interest to align with European rules. And we're doing that to reduce red tape on business and to take away costs. You know, you take in the food and drink sector, there's nearly a million export health certificates, up to £200 a time, fees paid by UK companies they'll no longer have to pay. Under the agreement we're striking.
But Minister, isn't there a danger that we end up in the worst of all worlds, where we end up being, in a whole number of sectors, a rule taker with rules that are being set by Brussels that we dynamically align with, and we end up in the worst of all worlds where we're no longer part of the club making the rules, but no longer fully out of the club, able to set our own rules in a way which aligns with our own national interest?
No, I disagree. I think that the pragmatic approach that we're taking, the ruthlessly pragmatic approach, is absolutely in our national interest.
To just do what Brussels wants?
Not at all. We will have a rule-shaping role. Yes, we will align in those sectors where it's in our interest to do so. There will obviously then be an independent arbitration panel to arbitrate on disputes. But it also means we have the benefit of trade deals that we're striking, trade deal with India that we've struck, also the economic deal with the United States.
But fundamentally, Minister, on most of the sectors that you're talking about, Brussels will be the main player in terms of setting those rules, won't they? Let's just level with people, level with listeners. Ultimately, Brussels will be the primary rule maker in the sectors with which we will align.
But the point is, though, Lewis, that if you export into another market, you have to export products to the standard of that market. And the reality is,
you don't have to necessarily align your own standards for all markets. You're talking about permanent regulatory alignment with Brussels.
Yeah, we are talking about, and by the way, dynamic alignment with Brussels, this is not some sort of dirty term we should be afraid of. Where it is in our interest to do that, take down barriers for businesses, we absolutely will do it. We're not governed by ideology. You know, I was mentioning earlier about the export health study. We're doing over 20-odd pages in some cases. I was shown one by a business, 56 wet stamps on it. I want to take those burdens and costs away from businesses. And yes, absolutely, I'm levelling with the public about that. That's the choice we are making, the choice to bear down on prices, a choice to take away red tape from businesses. And we are actively in our national interest choosing to dynamically align in certain sectors, yes.
And if the EU say that a price for that and for greater integration with the single market is that we need to make annual payments into European budgets, is that a price worth paying?
Well, we make the judgment on financial contributions as to whether it's in our overall economic interest. So, for example, you looked at just before Christmas, There was the participation in what was known as the Safe Defence Loans Fund. I took a judgment that wasn't in the interest of the UK taxpayer, so I didn't sign up for it. In contrast, I secured a 30% discount to sign up to Erasmus Plus, which is going to be not just a student exchange scheme, Lewis, but those securing vocational qualification, professionals as well, being able to have the chance to sample cultures overseas. There where I struck a deal that was in the interest of the British taxpayer, I signed up to it. It's exactly that principle that I will continue when we're looking at financial contributions.
So to be clear, the reporting today is correct, that the EU has asked us to make contributions. It's been reported about £1 billion a year into European budgets as a condition of further access to the EU single market.
No, I don't recognise that figure at all. It's already the case, and it's in the public domain from a few weeks ago, that the negotiations I'm conducting on participation in the European electricity market, which, by the way, would help with energy security and bear down on prices, it's already in the EU mandate that they are will seek to negotiate a financial contribution. But again, that's subject to negotiation. I judge it in terms of the overall benefit that there is to the UK taxpayer.
So, but to be clear, you don't recognise £1 billion, but you are willing to consider financial contributions into the EU's budget as a price worth paying.
I've already made, and the previous government, by the way, on the Horizon Research Programme made a contribution. That principle is already well established. It's about judging whether, in particular areas, it represents our national interest and value for money with the UK taxpayers. The approach I've used the last 2 years, I'll continue to.
And just finally, Minister, on domestic politics, obviously a big week coming up, local elections, national elections in your part of the world, in Wales for the Senedd, in Scotland as well. They're widely expected to be a difficult night for the Labour Party. No matter how bad those results are, does the Prime Minister have your full support in continuing his job?
Well, firstly, we will be doing everything to ensure that we maximise the Labour vote right across the country on Thursday. The Prime Minister absolutely has my full support. He won a 5-year mandate from the country in July 2024. He needs to continue and deliver and be judged on that.
And would you like to see Andy Burnham back in Parliament?
Oh, look, I'm not getting into any of this speculation about the future. This is about this week focusing on the election and, secondly, supporting the Prime Minister to deliver for the country.
Nick Thomas-Simmons there, the Minister for the Constitution, in charge of UK-EU relations, speaking to us live from Armenia, where the Prime Minister is. Continue your thoughts on all of that, 03456060973. And after the news, we're going to be speaking about a story which, in my view, ought to have got a lot more attention than it has. It is Nigel Farage and a curious case of the £5 million, apparently unconditional gift from a Thailand-based crypto billionaire. That's coming up, 11:01.
Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock, the Prime Minister is in Armenia as part of efforts to forge closer ties with Europe. Sir Keir Starmer has acknowledged there is tension among Western allies.
We cannot deny that some of the alliances that we have come to rely on are not in the place we would want them to be. There is more tension in the alliances than there should be. And it's very important that we therefore face up to this as a group of countries together.
He is due to make clear his plans for the UK to be part of a multi-billion pound loan for Ukraine to fight Russia. There are also reports this morning that Brussels would expect Britain to pay £1 billion a year as part of a reset. Iran has threatened to attack US forces if they help to freeze stranded ships stuck in the Strait of Hormuz. Donald Trump has promised to start guiding vessels using aircraft and guided missile destroyers, but didn't specify what role the US Navy will play. He's called it a humanitarian gesture, as many are running low on food. NATO chief Mark Rutte insists Europe is ready to support opening the key shipping route.
I see more and more European countries pre-positioning essential logistical and other support close to theater so that for the next phase they are ready. So I would argue there has been some disappointment from the US side, but the Europeans have listened.
The World Health Organization says the risk to the wider public following a hantavirus outbreak on a cruise ship remains low. Three people have died while a British man is in hospital in South Africa after falling ill on the MV Hondius. The disease is typically spread by rodents. An area in Bristol has now been declared safe following an explosion at a house killing two people. Three others, including a child, were also taken to hospital yesterday. Almost all residents have now been able to return home following the major incident. And Buckingham Palace has revealed Princess Eugenie is pregnant with her third child with husband James Brooksbank. The King is said to be delighted. LBC weather: showers for southern England, South Wales and northern Scotland. Brighter for southern Scotland, but mostly cloudy elsewhere. A high of 19 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Amelia Cox.
Virgin Media gives you show-stopping TV and broadband. You get the channels you love, including Netflix and now Sky Atlantic at no extra cost. That's epic entertainment you can't stop watching. A bit like an elephant cruising on a truck through the bright lights of Bangkok. Plus, you get lightning-fast broadband too. Yeah, that's entertainment the Virgin Media way. Visit virginmedia.com. New customers only. Virgin Fiber areas. Restrictions and credit checks apply. Terms apply.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Lewis Goodall.
Time is 11.04. Lewis Goodall sitting in for James O'Brien this Bank Holiday Monday here on LBC. Look, there is obviously, it's a big week for domestic politics. We've got those really, really crucial elections coming up on Thursday, the biggest democratic stress test for all the major parties, especially, of course, Keir Starmer's government, this side of the next general election. And there has, of course, been, rightly so, a great deal of scrutiny on Keir Starmer, the government, his actions, Peter Mandelson, what's going on in Iran, this, that, and the other. There has been another big story over the course of the last week, which I have to say I've been pretty astonished has received such scant attention. Particularly when you consider this. Cast your mind back to those early days in the summer of 2024 of Starmer's government. I think it's fair to say that he did not enjoy a honeymoon. If he did, it was basically a dodgy, wet weekend in Bognor. No offence to Bognor. And he ended up in a situation where very quickly he was in the mire, stuck in the quicksand of what was called a scandal. I said at the time, I didn't think it was much of a scandal. I think it was a lot of hypocrisy on all sides in politics and the media. But of course, you'll remember it as Freebiegate. Huge, huge attention being paid into whether the Prime Minister had received a free pair of glasses from party donor Lord Alley, or he'd received, got some new suits and a tie, and Victoria Starmer had got a few new frocks. And then we had a situation where the Chancellor of the Exchequer was being absolutely lacerated over accepting some corporate hospitality to see a Sabrina Carpenter tour or ticket or whatever it was, concert. And on and on and on it went. And we had endless hand-wringing from journalists in particular. Journalists who, in my experience, are no stranger to a little bit of corporate hospitality on occasion, deciding to criticise politicians for accepting what were, in the grand scheme of things, pretty minor free gifts. Angered a lot of people, but and some people, I think, perfectly legitimately, and there were some legitimate questions to ask about it, but it went on and on and on. In numerical terms, of course, the value of these gifts was very low, almost nugatory in some cases. And yet over the course of the last week, we've seen a gift with relation to a party political leader of an enormous amount, £5 million previously undisclosed. And yet it has barely caused a ripple in the pages of the national media. I'm referring, of course, to the £5 million that Nigel Farage, we now know thanks to The Guardian, accepted just before he was elected to Parliament in 2024 from a Thailand-based, UK citizen, but Thailand-based crypto billionaire. And that isn't all, because it is, of course, this same man who last year gave Reform the biggest donation in British political history in the summer of 2025 to the tune of £9 million. And then he decided to top it off with a further £3 million in the final quarter of 2025. To put that into context, consider that's £12 million. Put that into context. In 2025, according to the Electoral Commission, the total amount donated to every single political party in the country, from the biggest political party, the Conservative, Labour Party and so on, right down to the kind of, you know, little Sodbury Residents Association party, right down and everything in between, you had about £65 million of donations being given and donated. That means 12 million went to one party, huge amount of that. huge proportion of that went to one party from one man. We have never seen anything like it before. And he wasn't alone, because we've also seen in that time, and you bear in mind, just thinking about the figures of that, 12 million means that Reform were given about a fifth of all the money donated to all the political parties in Britain in 2025 from one man. And bear in mind that when you go down the list for the Reform donations, he's got that 12 million donate, 9 million donation, then he's got that 3 million donation. The next lot of donations down are about 12 times smaller. About a quarter of a million here, a quarter of a million there. Still big money from big donors, but of a different league, a different order of magnitude by comparison to the money that this man, Christopher Harborne, has given, as I say, a Thailand-based crypto billionaire. Very mysterious character. Harborne himself is a major shareholder in a company called Tether. Now, Tether is registered in the Central American dictatorship of El Salvador. Now, with a tiny staff, Tether has been described as the most profitable company in per employee in history. It has issued some $184 billion in digital cash known as stablecoins. Now, here, coincidentally enough, remarkably enough, is Nigel Farage talking on this very station to my colleague Nick Ferrari some time ago. And what does he happen to mention? He mentions that company, Tether. Listen to this.
Tether is a stable coin. Stable coins are the way which money goes from conventional currencies through into cryptocurrencies and back again. Tether is about to be valued as a $500 billion company. You know, stable coins, crypto, this world is enormous. And I've been urging for years that London should embrace it. We should become a global trading centre for this stuff under proper regulation. And the governor of the Bank of England earlier this week indicated that nobody, no individual, should be allowed to have more than £10,000 worth of stable coins. To which some of my friends have said, should we just emigrate?
So there's Nigel Farage waxing lyrical about the virtues of crypto, about Bitcoin and so on. A world that is still pretty shadowy, largely unregulated, still emerging, and about which there are huge regulatory questions to be put and posed to it. Now, we should say that both Mr. Farage and Mr. Harborne have made clear that the party donations and the personal gift with which Mr. Farage is saying is related to his security needs as an individual, a politician who has been targeted in the past. That's what he says the money is for. It is unconditional, they say, entirely unconditional, and has nothing to do with the fact that the Reform Party has perhaps the most favourable sets of policies towards crypto. They are the most pro-crypto party of any of the major parties. They say that it's completely unconditional. Nonetheless, we see the money and we follow the money, and we do see that there's £12 million that have been donated. Previously, there had been money donated to the forerunner of the Reform Party, the Brexit Party, as well. And of course, we did not know until The Guardian reported it about this £5 million personal gift. Now, the Tories say and Labour say that Nigel Farage has broken parliamentary rules by refusing, by not disclosing it. He says it's a private matter. We do know, as I say, that Nigel Farage is an evangelist for crypto, so much so that we saw Kwasi Kwarteng, the former Tory Chancellor, for about 10 seconds, announcing last year that Nigel Farage had joined his crypto scheme.
This is Kwasi Kwarteng. I'm the executive chairman of Stan. We all know that Bitcoin treasury companies are relatively new. The next stage of growth requires institutional credibility. What we're building at Stack is a model, a template for how these companies should evolve. And it's very important that we manage to build strategic partnerships and alliances to really push this journey forward. I'm delighted to announce the participation of Nigel Farage and blockchain.com. Nigel Farage is a great political disruptor, but beyond all of that, he's someone who has championed Bitcoin over many years, and we're delighted to have him. Already, blockchain.com has established itself at the center of the Bitcoin ecosystem, made trillions of dollars of transactions in its history, and we're delighted to welcome them on board. To have a senior frontline politician, but also someone who's passionate about financial services, and to have one of the great cryptocurrency companies together working with us is not only a privilege, but a huge endorsement for what we're trying to do. From my own personal point of view, I think this is one of the most exciting developments in the financial architecture of the United Kingdom. We are Stack BTC.
That's Kwasi Kwarteng announcing that Farage had joined his crypto company, or invested in it, I should say, last year. Now, again, Nigel Farage and Christopher Harborne, they deny any impropriety. They say these gifts and these donations, they are entirely without condition. Nonetheless, my point to you and the question I have is that given we got so worked up about the gifts and corporate hospitality, which were trifling in their value by comparison to the amount of money and gift that has been given by Mr. Harborne, the question is, why did that get so much attention and this is not? I mean, you could not move on other broadcasters and on the newspapers during those early days of the Labour government without, frankly, there were consistent suggestions that something improper had been done by Keir Starmer, Rachel Reeves and others. And yet this story, as I say, we've got the biggest donation in British political history. Two donations worth £12 million, with more to come, we're told, potentially by Christopher Harborne. It means that reform are unusually dependent on the funds from this one man. And now we learn as well that Mr. Farage accepted what we're told was an unconditional gift before he became a Member of Parliament of £5 million, which Mr. Farage says is for his security needs. Surely at the very least, particularly for a party that says it wants to, you know, be out there for the people's army, that they're a populist force, they're an insurgent force, they're a grassroots force, and yet we also learn they're highly dependent on the funds from a Thailand-based, doesn't even live in the UK, Thailand-based crypto billionaire. How does that make sense? How do you answer that? And how does it be, or how can it be, that we have such attention on something like Freebiegate, and yet in the media there is almost nothing on this? Should we be worried about big money in politics? And should we be worried that Mr. Harborne, who has said that he intends to get around any ban that the Labour government is planning to put in place on foreign-based party donation, might continue to sweep UK politics with his money? 0345 60 60 973. A little bit of breaking news as well. US warship intending to pass through the Strait of Hormuz has been turned back after ignoring Iran's warning. Fars news agencies, Iranian-based news agencies, reporting on Monday, citing local sources, adding that two missiles hit it when it was sailing. So we'll keep up to date with that. It's obviously potentially quite a major escalation. Iranian media saying two missiles have hit a US warship in the Strait of Hormuz. We'll obviously keep a very close eye on that and bring you the latest. I'll also bring you an interview I did with one of the Guardian journalists who's been working on this Nigel Farage story. Should we be worried about a single party donor giving Reform £12 million and we're told, giving him a personal gift of £5 million? 0345 60 60 973. Do you remember all that hullabaloo there was when everyone was getting very worked up that Elon Musk might flood British politics with his money? And then, of course, spectacularly, he fell out with Nigel Farage and others. Well, it turns out it doesn't look like reform needs him. Time is 11:16.
LBC.
In the Wren Spring Sale, you can get an amazing deal faster than you can say incredible value. Visit your local Wren showroom right now and get up to 60% off our high-quality, fully-built kitchen units and up to 7 years interest-free credit. Made for giving your kitchen a new beginning this spring. Wren, made for living. Offers apply when you buy five or more kitchen units. Finance subject to status, minimum spend.
With an Amex business card, Selena's earning points renovating her skin clinic and refreshing the builders.
14 coffees and 28 sugars, please.
And on new adjustable chairs for every room. And she can use the points to lie back and relax.
Don't put ice cream on your brother's head.
Well, sometimes. And that's because with an Amex business card, your points can go towards holidays and more.
Search Amex business card. Interest fees and terms apply. Available to UK limited companies and limited liability partnerships. Signatories must be a director or member of the business. Subject to approval.
Lost World Play Barn, Dragon Castle Children's Farm, Jumping Pillows, Wallabies, Froggy Soft Play. Tommy Tractor Play Barn, Quaterpillar Rowing Boats, Owl Displays, Meerkats, Honey Pot Bears. And four giant slides on the brand new Wave Runner 2. Let's plunge!
What's next, Dad?
Cannon Arena Lemurs, Jungle Kingdom Go-Karts, Trampolines, Magical Wood and Cafes.
Nutcatch Adventure Park.
The fun goes on and on and on and on.
Book now at nutcatch.com.
So, you're geared up for this Making Tax Digital thing?
Sure, I just need some new mud boards, bag of cavity tyres and a couple of lintels.
Hey, MTD, mate. Digital taxes.
Mm-hmm. It's an extension down Station Road on a corner.
Dave, digital taxes, mate.
Yeah. Probably will need some 2x4s. I want to go to take the van in for a new fan belt. Squeaky.
Hey, Making Tax Digital, Dave.
Avoiding MTD. Sage makes tax simpler for sole traders. Search Sage MTD to get your free software today.
Lewis Goodall on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
Time is 11:19. A reminder of that breaking news. Iran has said that it has stopped a US warship from entering the Strait of Hormuz. It has hit that US warship with two missiles near Yask Island after it ignored Iranian warnings. That is according to Iranian local media. Additionally, Iran's Navy has said that it prevented the entry of US warships into the Strait. This is after Donald Trump said the US would start guiding ships safely out of the waterway. Iran has said the move will be considered a violation of the ceasefire. So, events moving quickly in the Middle East, and of course we'll keep a very close eye on that. It looks and it appears as if Iran is showing once again that whatever the US says and whatever Donald Trump, however much he huffs and puffs, he simply is unable militarily to open the strait by force. So of course we'll bring you the latest on that when we have it. Yesterday on my Sunday programme, the imaginatively titled Sunday with Lewis Goodall, I spoke with Tom Burgess. He's the investigations correspondent at The Guardian, who wrote a really interesting profile on Christopher Harborne. As I say, this is the donor behind that £5 million, we're told, unconditional gift. He's a crypto billionaire. It was received by Nigel Farage. He's also given £12 million, the biggest donation in British political history, the last year that we've ever seen. I began by asking Tom, who's, as I say, written an excellent profile, which you should read, what do we know about this rather shadowy but nonetheless increasingly significant figure in British politics?
Well, his lawyers would say he's an intensely private man. He doesn't, well, until very recently, he'd never given interviews. He gave one to the Telegraph last week. But since then, we've heard, before then, we'd heard nothing. He lives in Thailand, mostly. Unlike a lot of big donors, he doesn't sort of tell us what his motivations are. We know that he was born in the UK, 1962, near Sheffield. We know he had a kind of elite upbringing, private school, and then Cambridge, and then a French prestigious business school. And then he makes his way to Thailand in the 1990s, during the crisis there. He makes millions. And then he sets up on his own, making even more money. And what really turbocharges his wealth is cryptocurrency. It can put off a lot of readers and listeners, but essentially just new forms of digital cash issued by private individuals and companies instead of by countries. And Christopher Harborne, or Chakrit Sakankrit, to give him his Thai name, he is one of the barons of the cryptocurrency world. He's channeled a lot of his money into the Conservatives, yes, but on a massive scale, Nigel Farage and Reform UK. And Nigel Farage, as we've seen, has become a huge enthusiast for cryptocurrency.
Yes, we should say that it is Nigel Farage and Mr. Harborne say that there is no relationship whatsoever with Nigel Farage's party's policy or views on crypto and these enormous sums. But it is true to say, isn't it, that much like his great hero, Donald Trump, Nigel Farage has become something of an advocate for crypto, talking about the idea that Britain and the City of London is being left behind, and almost certainly has the most pro-crypto policies of any of the major parties in Westminster.
Yes, I think you're right to stress that they both say, listen, there is no connection between these millions and millions that have flowed from Christopher Harborne to Farage's political project and his support for crypto. I did call up, when I was working on my big Guardian profile of Harborne, I did call up Gawain Towler, who's I'm sure you know, and many of your listeners will know, he's been a sort of communications chief for a long time for Nigel Farage. And I said, well, where did Nigel Farage's enthusiasm for crypto begin? And Towler, he took it back to early 2019, those crucial months heading into those European elections that year when we still didn't know if Leave or Remain would triumph. And that's when Chris Harborne arrived on the scene. The Brexit Party was brand new. It was a shambles. In goes the beginning of Harborne's donations, which will grow and grow and grow and grow into many millions. And yeah, there is no quid pro quo that anyone has ever identified of Harborne saying to Farage, I'll give you this money if you back crypto. But you can see Farage becoming a huge crypto enthusiast, and specifically for a cryptocurrency called Tether, which is an enormous cryptocurrency. There are nearly $200 billion worth of these digital tokens around. And Farage lately has been very energetically supporting this. He's been on LBC championing it. Now, the difficulty here is that Tether, sure, it has legit uses, but it's also, by Tether's own admission, become very, very popular with those who use cryptocurrency for nefarious purposes. So hacking, scamming, sanctions busting, even in support of the Russian war effort in Ukraine. Now, I'd say a pressing question for Farage is to say, well, what do you say about those nefarious uses of Tether, given that Tether is owned by a handful of people? It's worth an enormous amount of money. And one of the handful of people who own Tether, the company that issues this cryptocurrency, is his mega donor, Christopher Harborne.
We've also seen, beyond just the donations, which are enormous now, we've revealed this week by your colleague Anna Isaacs, we've seen this extraordinary gift, apparently unconditional gift, of some £5 million that was made just before Nigel Farage returned to Parliament, was elected to Parliament, I should say, not returned, was elected to Parliament in the 2024 general election. So that brings the total amount of money that Mr. Harborne has given Nigel Farage and or his party to just, you know, £17 million or so. This is an extraordinary amount of money. We've never really seen anything, as far as I can recall, like it before in British politics.
It's actually way more than that, because he started in 2019 when Reform UK was called the Brexit Party, right? It's the same thing, it's just got a different name now. So he gave millions and millions in 2019 to the Brexit Party. So I think if you tot it up and you add in that new 5 million, you're actually looking at more like 27 million. And Reform UK, that makes Reform UK uniquely dependent of political parties in the UK on a single benefactor, yes.
And from your reporting and your very interesting piece in The Guardian, did you get sense from Reform people you were talking to about some disquiet about this dependency?
I spoke to Emma Nicholson. She was a friend of Chris Harborne's sister, late sister, and she's a Conservative peer. She was worried. She thinks, to use her expression, she says, oh, Nigel is mad to accept his money. I think the bigger disquiet I heard was sort of twofold, really. One is on behalf of us all. You know, democracy works by ensuring that those we choose to rule us, their actions are in our interests, our collective interests. And in order to police conflict of interests, we have to understand the business interests and business activities of these big donors. And the more political funding is concentrated in the hands of a few people, the more there is the risk, of course, that our rulers will act in their interests rather than the collective interests. And I tell you, the second question that comes up is a sort of simpler one, actually, of is there more? You know, as you said, and I, my brilliant colleague, broke the story of the 5 million gift to Nigel Farage in 2024. But is there more? I mean, there could have been other gifts,
And just very briefly to come back on that, Tom, as well. I mean, we can have that debate, and they've been asked about it, and they say it's unrelated to his political work, and it was to guarantee his security, and so on and so forth. But I do note, and I do recall, that one of the early quote-unquote scandals of the Starmer government, from which actually quite a bit of rot started to set in terms of public perception, fairly or unfairly, was this question of Freebiegate. And we were talking about donations of glasses or a couple of pair of suits or some Sabrina Carpenter tickets for the Chancellor. That received enormous media attention, absolutely unrelenting for a period of weeks and even months. But I note that this £5 million, which is obviously by definition of an extraordinarily higher order of magnitude than any of that, has got relatively little attention.
Well, I mean, here we are talking about it on your popular show. That's a good sign, isn't it? But yes, I think it's legitimate to scrutinise all the parties and all their potential conflict of interest. But it is also true that the sums involved here are massive. I wonder whether it has anything to do with this, I'd say, quite remarkable development of political parties, in this case, Reform, making legal threats to journalists about their scrutiny of political funding, which does seem to me not a particularly healthy thing in a democracy.
That was Tom Burgess, investigations correspondent at The Guardian, speaking to me on my Sunday show yesterday. It should say a spokesperson for Reform has said that this £5 million was a personal, unconditional gift, and Nigel Farage's decision to stand as an MP was entirely unrelated to that gift. They said this gift was given when Nigel was retired from frontline politics. A while after the gift was given, Nigel confirmed he wouldn't stand at the next general election. He then reversed his decision to stand in June. Nonetheless, I think what is legitimate for us to consider is why it is that this gift has received relatively little attention by comparison to all of that Freebiegate stuff we had at the start of the Starmer government, and whether, frankly, there is just too much big money in politics, full stop, in terms of funding for political parties. Andrew is in Darlington. Andrew, something to say about this?
Yeah, I just thought, Lewis, before I say anything, I just want to say I haven't actually got a tinfoil hat on.
Right.
But I think that the mistake that lots of people are making is this: these are short-term incidents, that Trump is a short-term incident, that Orban is a short-term incident. They really, really aren't. There was a realization, I think partly led by very wealthy right-wing American billionaires in the 60s and 70s, that because of demographics more than anything, their ability to win elections would reduce over time. So they set about effectively trying to destroy democracy and reintroduce a thing called neo-feudalism.
Right.
And you do that by taking your average person and making decisions difficult, by sowing division. Sound familiar?
Yeah.
And then you pay for it. You also look at your enemies, or the enemies of democracy, and say, why don't we work with you? We've got the same goals. So you end up with this bizarre situation where American billionaire capitalists basically are supporting Putin in weakening the European Union or destroying NATO.
What's this got to do with Christopher Harborn and Farage, Andrew, to bring it back to that?
Because he's a foreign billionaire of enormous...
To be clear, he's a British citizen, but he's based in Thailand.
Doesn't matter. Why is he living in Thailand? I'd count that as foreign.
Well, he's foreign-based, that's absolutely certain. And indeed, the Labour government is proposing to change election rules, which means that you can't donate. But Christopher Harborn said he'll get around it, so...
Well, exactly. And effectively, so has Musk.
That's what he's been reported as saying, I should say.
So has every other billionaire. You know, Orban, Le Pen, Maloney... Farage, you know, Farage has had so many different suits. This, you know, look at the time span. You look at John Birch Society trying to take over the American PTA in the 70s. This is a really long-term project. And yet all the people who you might term a reasonable, liberal, whatever, are going, oh, well, it's only 5 years. It really isn't.
All right, Andrew, grateful to you. I should say, I don't think Nigel Farage has had anything to do with the John Birch Society, but it's certainly true to say that there are projects on the right around the world that talk together and consider themselves part of the same project. Obviously, Nigel Farage is closely associated or has been with the MAGA movement. Your thoughts on whether we need to stop this sort of big money in British politics in terms of funding political parties? Why don't we just have state-funded political parties like other countries do, and this stuff just wouldn't arise, and you wouldn't have to worry about union money or foreign donor money or whatever it happens to be? 0345 60 60 973. You can WhatsApp at the same number, text 84850. We're also going to be keeping an eye, of course, on what feels like pretty significant news, that the Iranians have hit a US warship in the Strait with two missiles, and that warship has, tail tucked between its legs, turned around, despite Donald Trump saying that he would use the US military, the US Navy, to open up the Strait and go and rescue some of the ships and mariners who are stuck within it. We'll be following that, of course, closely for the next 90 minutes and throughout the day on LBC. Let's get the latest LBC News headlines now, 11:32 with Amelia Cox.
Sir Keir Starmer has alluded to heightened tension between Donald Trump, Europe and NATO. The Prime Minister is in Armenia, where he is looking to build closer ties with the EU. Iranian state media says two of its missiles have hit a US warship after it ignored warnings not to enter the Strait of Hormuz. The President earlier promised to free ships which are stranded along the key shipping route. And South Africa's health ministry says a British tourist is in a critical condition in hospital following a suspected hantavirus outbreak on a cruise. cruise ship. Three people have died after falling ill on the MV Hondius. LBC weather: showers for southern England, South Wales and northern Scotland. Brighter for southern Scotland, but mostly cloudy elsewhere. A high of 19 degrees.
This is LBC.
Whoa, your skin is looking gorge. What are you using?
It's the Me Plus BHA Toner. There's a money-back guarantee on Superdrug's own brand skincare, so I figured I'd give it a go.
Even if you've used it?
Yep, it's given me the confidence to try something new, and I found a new skincare staple.
A stress-free way to find new skincare faves. Yes, please.
Superdrug own brand skincare. See results or your money back.
Keep receipt for refund of purchase price. Fair use policy applies. Guarantee is in addition to statutory rights, which remain unaffected. Visit superdrug.com/moneyback for full T's and C's.
Travelling to Ireland for a wedding? Yoo-hoo! Say I do to Irish Ferries. For a start, you can keep the suit hung up neatly in the car. That stunning wedding hat won't look like a flat cap when you unpack it. And you'll have plenty of time to unwind on the way home to help you get over that awkward incident mentioned in the best man speech. It was a little too close to the bone. For a more easygoing way to travel, book now at irishferries.com. Irish Ferries. See travel differently.
With Amex Platinum, Laura earns points on...
Can I have the soup and the salad and the tart?
And gets access to the Centurion Airport Lounge too.
Let's have a little relax, a little pudding.
And could use her points to travel for...
Las gambas con mantequilla y...
And that's because with dining, travel and lifestyle benefits, there's always more with Amex Platinum.
Representative 685.3% APR variable. Annual fee. Terms apply. 18 plus. Subject to approval. Rates may vary.
It's hard to concentrate when you can't shake a health worry. It can feel like there's a wall between you and the rest of the world. Like you can't be fully present.
Hello, AXA Health. How can I help?
If something's playing on your mind, AXA Health support line nurses and counsellors are ready to listen day or night. For cover that cares, search AXA Health Insurance. 24/7 health support line available to all members. Treatment for pre-existing conditions is not covered.
Nurses.
Leading Britain's conversation, LBC, with Lewis Goodall.
Time is 11:35. We're returning to that conversation and that discussion about Nigel Farage, the £5 million apparently unconditional gift, the £12 million in reform funding from one Thailand-based crypto billionaire. But of course, we'll return to what I think is going to be the news that probably dominates the day. This is Iran's Navy preventing what they call an American Zionist warship entering the Strait of Hormuz, apparently, according to local media, attacking with two missiles, which has led the US ship to turn around and exit the strait. This follows Donald Trump saying that he would use the US Navy to rescue some of the mariners who have been stranded in the strait since this crisis began. Apparently, yet again, we are seeing the limits of American naval power in this theatre of the world. Let's talk now to Vice Admiral Duncan Potts, former Assistant Chief of Naval Staff and Control of the Navy from 2013 to 14. Thanks so much for joining us this morning, Vice Admiral. Can we just get a sense from you, how significant do you think this is, the Iranians hitting the US, that US ship, we're told, with two missiles?
Yeah, well, if indeed it's happened, it's a significant escalation. From what I can see, this is just reports from Iranian news agencies yet. So, like all these things, I would I'd want to see independent verification of that, or some statement from the states. And some of the, you know, when they say it's turned around and hightailed from the area, if it had genuinely been hit by two missiles, that may well be disabling. So I think we need to see what has happened. But what it does say is that it appears that America, with its new operation this morning, is keen to force the Straits to return trade through the Straits there. And, you know, this has been almost inevitable from since the 28th of February.
Assuming, as you say, and we have only had it from Iranian state media, although it is being picked up by Western news agencies around the world, assuming it has happened, presumably Donald Trump will treat this, as you say, as a significant escalation.
Yes, and it is. I mean, if it is genuinely a missile, and knowing the area well, and I know JASC and the area, I would make the assumption that it's a shore-based launch anti-ship cruise missile. This is a major attack. It would have caused major damage. Some people may remember from the tanker war when the USS Stark was hit by an Exocet missile. This sounds something similar to that as well. That was a major escalation as well. And yes, we could see a rapid escalation in the area.
And could you just explain for listeners and viewers, because it is an intriguing and obviously for them involved, distressing subplot of all of this. I mean, the reason this has come about, at least this is what the president says, is that he wants to use the US Navy to try and rescue or assist the 20,000 mariners, seafarers on 2,000 ships that have been stuck in the strait since the war began. So those people and those ships have simply been stuck there since February.
Yes, correct. I mean, the history of the Straits goes back. I mean, this is the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. This has been their playbook now since the 1980s and the Iran-Iraq War. And they know they've had the leverage. They've gone asymmetric in terms of using multiple small boats. They've now got drones. They've got submarines. They've got mines. And they've got, coastal defense cruise missiles as well that they can use, but it's an international strait. It's been recognized as such for hundreds of years. The right of freedom of navigation is very clear in international law. And, I can absolutely understand the US needing to get that open up again. You know, we all know the statistics now, 20% of all global hydrocarbons plus many other products go through that area.
Perhaps this is a reminder, though. I mean, although, as you say, assuming it's happened, it will be a significant escalation. In one sense, does it not simply reaffirm the strategic nightmare conundrum into which Trump has placed himself, which is that when it became clear that the regime was not going to fall using air power alone, at the very least, that there was no obvious way of using naval power to reopen the strait, and therefore, however much he huffs and puffs and gets angry, Iran ultimately is in the driving seat, at least for the moment.
Well, Iran, geography plays to Iran here. Iran is the northern coastline of the Straits of Hormuz, where it canalizes in from the Gulf of Oman. Very narrow, just for your listeners, it's like Dover to Calais. It's a very narrow strait where all that shipping has to go through. And the Revolutionary Guard Corps have developed a navy over 40 years, which is optimized for that. They've got swarm tactics. They've got lots of very small vessels, relatively cheap capability to be able to cause damage there. But equally, having operated out there and having sailed through the Straits of Hormuz and been a former commander of a task group for the Americans in the region, I'm sure they know all the threats. It's been the focus of Fifth Fleet, which is the CENTCOM maritime component commander there, for decades now. And the Royal Navy was out there for decades to force this very thing. So I think we need to see what happens. But if a major US warship has been hit by Iranian missiles, this is definitely the ceasefire I'm sure the Americans will see as absolutely over.
Is geography really all conquering in this, Vice Admiral? I mean, just finally, is there? I mean, I think one of the things that I think has surprised the president himself is that there is a sort of assumption that the full might of the U.S. Navy, U.S. armed forces would, in some sense or way, be able technologically with its prowess to overcome even geographical advantages that Iran might have. But it seems that that is not the case, that geography is humbling even the awe of the US military and armed services.
Yeah, the geography is very difficult there. And certainly at sea, I used to talk all the time about warning and reaction time. So if you're literally sailing very close to the coast, and I notice with a new mission, the US had moved the traffic scheme much closer to Oman as well to increase that warning and reaction time that you need. But equally, the reports this morning that were coming out, the amount of maritime air power that was assigned to this, where they have complete dominance, you know, would have been covering that in terms of surveillance, but also in terms of capabilities to take out things that were coming off the shore as well. So I don't discount it. I've sailed through there. The greatest risk is of shore-based anti-ship cruise missiles that from the moment of launch to hitting you is measured in 1 or 2 minutes and seconds. So you've got to get your posture right to be able to counter them. But I would like to see exactly what has happened to see what the implication is.
Vice Admiral Duncan Potts there should say also, as ever with the fog of war, with this, we are seeing claim and counterclaim. So a senior US official is denying that a US ship was hit by Iranian missiles. This is being reported by Axios, the American media organisation. We'll try and bring the latest on this as we get it. But as the Vice Admiral was suggesting there, very often with these things you've got claim and counterclaim. But even if there is any truth to it whatsoever, and the fact that perhaps it has turned around or whatever it happens to be, then it is potentially still a serious escalation in the war. So we'll try and get exactly what the details are and what has happened and bring it to you as we get them. Let's talk to Hazel, who is in Angus, who wants to say something about Nigel Farage and foreign donations. Hazel, good morning.
Good morning. Well, I've been listening to you and it's been very interesting. And of course, I absolutely agree with you that it's ridiculous that all this is sort of going without any comment at all. But I just wanted to say, isn't this just the tip of the iceberg? Because as far as I've been reading about foreign donations, there have been three major donations which are backing reform of hundreds of billions of dollars, which has enabled them to have their own TV station, is it, that they have?
I'm not sure that they've received donations of hundreds of billions of dollars, Hazel. Well, I know they haven't. I mean, we know what donations they've received via the Electoral Commission, and by far the biggest is from Mr. Harbaugh.
Well, perhaps I'm reading the wrong things, but certainly on various media things that I've been looking at, they're saying that they're backed up by all this money coming from America. And this has obviously been gone for a while. It's not just now. And that's given them the opportunity to have their own outlets for their own publicity.
Well, I think to be clear, I mean, we should be, because it is important to get this right. It's certainly not the case that they've been receiving direct party donations from anybody other than those we've discussed. And there are other people who've donated, including other figures connected to crypto, I should say. But they are, in terms of the donations, as I say, about 12 times smaller. Even the second biggest is about 12 times smaller than the amount that Harbaugh has given. Now, of course, it doesn't mean that the kind of wider radical right movement or populist right movement isn't very well supported by very wealthy people. But in terms of direct party donations, that's what we know.
Okay.
All right. Okay, Hazel, grateful to you. There is a... look, it's important to get the facts right on this. And we should also say as well that Reform is not the only party by any stretch of the imagination to have been in receipt of significant amounts of foreign money and indeed large donations. For example, just before the general election, Labour was given £4 million from a tax haven-based hedge fund with, among other things, shares in oil and arms. So it is an old story in one sense, but it is certainly true that it is a new industry that is providing it to Reform, one about which many people feel uncomfortable. And we haven't, I think, seen before a party so dependent on the largesse of one single donor. And for that donor to be so top-heavy by comparison to the other donors that a party receives. And then, of course, as well, the extraordinary personal gift that we see of some $5 million, and I can't quite think of anything like that. And it wasn't disclosed. Nigel Farage says he didn't need to disclose it. Tories and Labour disagree. Nonetheless, something worth talking about. 0345 606 0973. The time is 11:47.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
Your colleague Ed Miliband wrote, profiting from a crisis is morally and economically wrong. Is he right?
Of course he's right. Absolutely.
Is it right for the British government to go after UK-listed companies the size of BP that they're morally and economically wrong?
Is the Jewish community under attack in this country, Sir Mark?
They're certainly under threat, absolutely. I think we have to recognise that we're dealing with the symptoms of a pandemic, perhaps, of anti-Semitism.
Home Secretary Shaban Mahmood, why have you failed so lamentably to protect Jewish people in this country?
There are also reviews into what more we need to do
in our NHS. Meanwhile, there are firebombs and people being stabbed. Can we stop with the reviews and have some action?
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
Donations to British Heart Foundation fund scientific research that can help save lives. People like Joe, who's pitching his next big business plan. Maria, who's sending out her wedding invitations. And Jack, who's just being a teenager again. Because when you donate, you fund more than just science. You help save lives. British Heart Foundation funds research that aims to cure inherited heart muscle diseases. But our work is not done. Donate now at bhf.org.uk and keep us beating.
Fever Tree Mediterranean Tonic Water. Who are you? Usually the mixer. The tea in G&T. But your delicate fragrance, hints of lemon thyme, when the tea's this good. Do you even need the G? Fever Tree, straight up or mixed. It's a matter of taste.
Hi, I'm Sava, founder of Cool You, the daddy of air conditioning. For over 15 years, Cool You have specialized in installing our fully internal aircon systems with no mess, no fuss, and no external condenser. Perfect for modern apartments, conservation areas, listed properties, or simply for those who don't want an ugly unit on the outside. Head to coolyou.london. Cool You, for a cool, comfortable home.
At Wickes, the Home and Garden event is now on. Save on Dulux Standard 2.5-litre coloured emulsion. Was £24, now £16. Ends Wednesday. Terms apply.
Have you spotted anything?
Only seagulls. Are you sure this beach is a nature reserve?
Well, the sign said, nature this way. Hey, what's that big bird over there? Flapping its wings? Unusual markings?
You sure that sign didn't say nature-ists?
Oi! This is a nudist beach!
Ooh. Now, where are my binoculars?
Cheryl!
Struggling to read in the sun? Get 2-for-1 at Specsavers and make prescription sunglasses your second pair. From £70 with standard single vision lenses to the same prescription. Terms and conditions apply. See in store for details.
Lewis Goodall on LBC. Text 84850.
Time is 11:50 and we're still trying to kind of get to the bottom of exactly what has happened with regards to these missiles. Been reported around the world and certainly via Iranian media initially that two missiles have been hit, or two missiles have hit a US warship in the Strait. There is a US official as yet unnamed but being reported in parts of the American media denying that those missiles have hit the US warship and denying the idea that it has turned away. But we'll, you know, try and sort of get the latest on that and we'll get it to you as and when we can. We seem to know though about this 3 people having died after a suspected hantavirus outbreak. Well, be careful how you say that. Hantavirus outbreak on a cruise ship in the Atlantic Ocean. The World Health Organization reporting 1 confirmed, 5 suspected cases aboard the MV Hondius ship. Fraser's in the studio. What is all this about? I never heard of this virus. Should I have? I get very nervous. We were just saying when I hear about a new virus, novel virus.
Yeah, I think there'll be a lot of people thinking the exact same this morning, Lewis. What is the hantavirus? This is a deadly virus that is often spread by rodents, and in particular their feces and their urine. Experts have said often when you are disturbed rat feces that's been sitting in a small area, it can make it airborne, and that's how people can contract it. Now, there's been a suspected outbreak of this on board the MV Hondius, which is a cruise ship that was sailing from Argentina towards the Canary Islands. It's been at sea for about 3 weeks, and we're told that 3 people have died. There's a British tourist who is in intensive care in hospital in South Africa, and there are 2 crew members on board that ship who are ill and trying to receive medical treatment. Now, the big issue that's currently facing this cruise ship and the cruise liner Oceanwide Expeditions is that where it's situated, just off the coast of Cape Verde, officials there are not giving permission for the passengers to disembark, and so any help that those crew members who are infected are getting is having to come out to the ship. Now, the World Health Organization this afternoon is trying to put a bit of calm out there. It said that the risk to the wider public is still very low and that there's no need for panic or for travel restrictions, but the global health expert Larry Gostin has told us nonetheless it's still very concerning.
I would be worried because the incubation period for hantavirus can be up to a week. And so it's possible that more cases will arise. And it's uncertain at this stage what, you know, preventive and precaution measures the cruise ship undertook. Clearly, it wasn't discovered in time, and the appropriate measures to intensely treat somebody with, you know, supportive care wasn't available. But unfortunately, there is no cure or treatment that actually can take away the symptoms like an antiviral medication.
And crucially, we're told that some strains of the hantavirus can be passed from human to human, although it is rare. But actually, the outcome of contracting this disease is that 40% of cases result in death. And that is where the big concern is coming here. One of the letters that I've seen on board that cruise ship now suggests that the passengers are being told to follow almost COVID-like restrictions. So wearing a mask, keeping social distancing, that sort of thing. Well, the Foreign Office has told us it's monitoring the situation very closely, especially with that British tourist confirmed to be in intensive care.
Fraser Knight, LBC reporter there, bringing us up to date on that pretty horrible story. Cruise ship, three dead suspected in suspected virus outbreak on this Atlantic cruise ship now not far from Europe. Let's return to this conversation about Nigel Farage. Phil is in Sidcup. Phil, something to say about why it is. I want to try and get to the bottom of it. Why is it the case that we obsess so much about Freebiegate and we've heard barely a word about this?
Well, I mean, I think this speaks to a wider point. I'm glad you brought up Labour, because I think we're importing a lot of this from the US anyway. The US has always been, for me, in the last X amount of decades or years, a plutocracy where elites are basically buying votes. And anyone who thinks they live in a democracy, I call it a faux democracy. But the thing for me is my concern is that this is the system that we operate in. It's a system's incentives to basically allow lobby groups. The city's got massive sway in Westminster. We know there's lobby groups in there for that sort of thing. So this isn't new to me. My concern is that we'll continue down this path, and mine and your vote will not really count for much if we don't have lots of money behind us or, you know, those types of funds to do that. And so I'm speaking more to the incentive structures of the system, and I think the system is operating as it should be. That's the incentives, and the post-World War II period was probably just an aberration. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and yes, I do. I see exactly what you mean. I mean, we used to pride ourselves that we didn't have kind of quite the sort of big money influence in British politics. Perhaps that was always a bit of an illusion and it was always there to some extent. But certainly I think we looked across the Atlantic and saw just how important money was in US politics, become even more important since the Citizens United judgment in the Supreme Court, which basically allowed companies to donate to political parties as if they were, or political candidates as if they were individuals, open the floodgates on an extraordinary amount of money sort of flowing in, changed American politics perhaps irredeemably. But do you think that that is, you really think that that's the direction that we're going in? And if it is, what could be done to stop it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, they talk about sortition, there's different ways of arranging things, but I don't know. But I think, like I say, for me, I think about things in systems. And when I look at the systems that I look at, whether it's the economy or the environment or ecology or Westminster, I just see systems and incentives. And if the incentive structure is set up so that basically money can be funneled through to pivot people or governments in a particular direction, then what we do at the ballot box, I don't think has much bearing on them. That's what I'm saying.
All right, Phil, your line isn't absolutely ideal, but I think we got the gist of what you were saying, so grateful to you for that. Del is in beautiful Edinburgh. Del, good morning.
Stolen my thunder.
That's all right. Well, it's nothing like a repeat storm, is there? So give it another go.
I know. I feel like my vote is being watered, and it's being watered down over decades. So it's irrelevant now who I vote for. Okay.
And explain what you mean by that, because people might not necessarily follow the link.
I think we're going down the road of American politics where money is the most important thing, and who controls the money is the most important thing. I think our votes at the end of the day are being lost to moneyed interests, foreign moneyed interests.
I mean, Mr. Harbaugh is clear that he expects nothing in return for the money.
Of course, because he lives in a foreign country and he has no interest in our country. I mean, it's ridiculous. All these British people that live abroad in tax-free havens who call themselves patriots, it's insulting to middle-class, poor people, lower-class, whatever, people, workers. you know, I don't want to promote Labour or anything, but we're getting all these noises from people in foreign countries about money.
Well, perhaps the answer, Del, is to finally just bite the bullet, and for Labour maybe to bite the bullet and do something that historically has been thought to be unpopular, which is you just take all the money out of politics and you do what the Germans do and other countries do, which is you have state funding of political parties. We already have it to some extent. You know, opposition parties get what they call short money, named after the Labour cabinet minister Ted Short. Maybe we should just go the whole hog and just say, right, well, you get this number of seats, you get this number of this amount of money, and there's a strict limit on how much you can spend, which we already have to some extent, and there we go.
For personal representation, Lewis.
Say that again, Adele.
Proportional representation.
Oh, PR. Oh, I see. Yeah, PR. Right. Yes. But you wouldn't necessarily have to have PR to do what I've just suggested. You could do it within the confines of our current system.
I mean, if we're watering down our votes from Labour, Conservative, and Liberal to different parties, then maybe proportional representation would work.
Well, it would work, but I mean, you know, you wouldn't necessarily have to have it in order to take big money out of the system. You could do that with what we've got now.
But money in the system is the problem.
I mean, we do have limits on what you can, political parties, strict limits on what political parties can spend in the short campaigns leading up to an election. Of course, it becomes a bit fuzzier in the run-up and beyond that particular period.
Yeah, I'm worried about our votes, Lewis. That's what I'm worried about.
Well, I understand that. Del, who is in Edinburgh, and I do think this is an important conversation to have because I think we heard from those last two callers there, and I think that is absolutely right, that there is a fear of an Americanization of our politics. I mean, it's happening in every direction almost. But I don't think we've quite got to the bottom of as well, though, which is a sort of slightly wider question, which is why has this story not received more attention? It is, even if you completely accept, and let's do so, even if you completely accept the account that's been given by Mrs. Farage and Harborne, that nothing is wanted for this, nothing is desired for it, there is no conditionality expected and so on. Nonetheless, £5 million gift after a £12 million donation in the year before, or the year after, I should say, that's the timeline of it. I mean, it is astounding. The perception of it, at least, could require at least some accounting for, and yet we look into the papers, newspapers, absolutely nothing, barely anything whatsoever, apart from the Guardian newspaper, which has been doing a lot of the running on the story. Very little on the BBC and elsewhere. Why is that? I think, well, at least if any of you have got any thoughts on that, we can drill into that specifically. We can continue it the next hour and talk about something else as well. 0345 6060 973. You're listening to Lewis Goodall sitting in for James O'Brien here on LBC. The time has just turned noon.
Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midday, a senior US official is denying claims by Iran that it has hit a US warship with two missiles in the Strait of Hormuz. Donald Trump earlier promised to free stranded ships along the key shipping route in a humanitarian gesture. Iranian state media says the vessel has turned back after ignoring warnings not to enter the strait. Former Assistant Chief of Naval Staff and Controller of the Navy, Vice Admiral Duncan Potts, has told LBC if true, it would be a serious escalation.
I mean, if it is genuinely a missile, I would make the assumption that it's a shore-based launch anti-ship cruise missile. This is a major attack. It would have caused major damage. Some people may remember from the tanker war when the USS Stark was hit by an Exocet missile. This sounds something similar to that as well. Yes, we could see a rapid escalation in the area.
Sir Keir Starmer has spoken of heightened tension between Donald Trump and Europe during a trip to Armenia. The Prime Minister is seeking to forge closer ties with Europe by joining a multi-billion pound loan for Ukraine. He says it will also help to create jobs in the UK while ensuring Kyiv has the right equipment to fight Russia. Minister for EU Relations Nick Thomas-Simmons has told LBC the government is acting in the national interest.
We, of course, have had issues where we've been in a different position from the President of the United States. But of course, it remains a reliable relationship. But this is a different context. We live in a more dangerous world where it is unquestionably the case where a closer UK-EU relationship is in our national interest, whether it's for prosperity, safety of our citizens, but also for security too.
The World Health Organization says the risk to the wider public from a hantavirus outbreak on a cruise ship remains low. Three people have died and a British man is in hospital in South Africa. Sir Alex Ferguson is understood to be recovering after being taken to hospital just before kick-off at Old Trafford. It's claimed the former Manchester United manager had sought precautionary medical attention yesterday. And the King is said to be delighted after Princess Eugenie announced she's pregnant with her third child. She already has two sons, August and Ernest, with husband James Brooksbank. LBC weather, showers for southern England, south Wales and northern Scotland. Brighter for southern Scotland, but mostly cloudy elsewhere. A high of 19 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Amelia Cox.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Lewis Goodall.
Time is 12.03. Matt in Sidcup says, are you really asking why the right-wing media gives their poster boy an easy ride as long as he doesn't get given a pair of specs, I guess? I mean, yeah, of course, Matt, in one sense, the answer is obvious. The papers, which are in so many ways, you know, still right-wing press, backing Farage and so on. But it doesn't explain all of the media and doesn't explain all the broadcast media, although the newspapers are so influential still. Extraordinarily, really, when you consider how much their readership has declined, but still remain extraordinarily powerful in setting the narrative and terms. They're not everything. Some, for example, I know a lot of people want to blame the media entirely for Starmer's travails and so on. It isn't true. It's partly true. It's too simplistic a take to just say, well, it's all the media's fault, if only the media were kinder to Starmer. But it is certainly true that very often they do set the agenda and narrative, and there can be no finer example or better example, I think, of that in the difference in how Freebiegate, so-called, a ridiculous kind of scandal, quote-unquote, really, is being treated by comparison to this story of the £5 million gift that Mr. Farage has received. Again, he says unconditionally, but nonetheless, those gifts, those corporate hospitality, they were given unconditionally as well. It's not like when the Chancellor got those Sabrina Carpenter tickets, the people who gave them to her, there was any suggestion that they had received something in exchange for them. Nonetheless, it animated so much of the media in a way that apparently this story simply has not. We're going to move on now, and also we should just say again that breaking news, though. A reporter from US outlet Axios saying that a senior US official, as yet unnamed, and of course it's still only pretty early in Washington, isn't named, has denied one of its ships has been hit by Iranian missiles. The Iranian military earlier claiming it had prevented a US Navy destroyer from entering the Strait of Hormuz. According to the claims by Fars, which is an Iranian news agency, the American ship was forced to retreat and flee the area. Pentagon not officially clarified yet. Of course, one of the weird things about this war is that you can never be entirely certain who to believe. Traditionally, we would obviously focus on what the Americans were saying, but it hasn't entirely true during this conflict. UAE is saying no injuries have been reported from the attack, though. That's the UAE saying no injuries reporting from the attack. So if that's the case, at least any potential escalation may be more limited. US Central Command also saying that no US Navy ships have been struck. So not for the first time in this conflict, two entirely competing parallel realities all at work at the same time. We'll bring you the latest on that as it happens, or as we hear it. So, moving on now, we are going to talk a little bit about something and hopefully have a nuanced conversation, although given the subject I'm about to discuss or about to bring up, the chance may be a fine thing. This is, of course, in relation to the marches that we're seeing or have seen ever since the appalling events, certainly then of October 7th, but then also, of course, in terms of what Israel has done in Gaza and then latterly Lebanon as well. Called hate marches by some, peace marches by others. Again, two competing worlds, two competing realities about the same event. I think the thing I really want to get at is that seems to be, to me, hypocrisy on almost every side, really, with regards to the way we're talking about these marches. And let's start with it on the right to begin with. I noted this weekend that there was a change in policy, or at least I think it was an intensification of their previous policy from the Conservative Party. Kemma Badenoch announced that she wanted to ban the marches because she feels that they have become incubators of anti-Semitism. Now, I want to say that I do think the anti-Semitism that is being received and is being unleashed upon Britain's jury is appalling, and it should be shameful for all of us. It really should. I mean, I've reported from Jewish schools, I've reported from Jewish cultural organisations, having to go to school basically under lock and key, under armed guard,
the local people having to act as a sort of surrogate police force in areas where lots of British Jews live. It should be absolutely shameful for all of us. The fact that there was 2025 was the worst year for anti-Semitic attacks on record in the UK in 2025. The fact that we've got a Met police chief saying that one of the greatest or the greatest terror threat faced by Britain today is the threat against Britain's Jews. It is shameful. And it should give all of us, even those, especially those, because there is no relation, there ought to be no relation between what Israel does and what British Jewry experiences. Many, many British Jews do not approve of what Israel has done, is doing. They're not Israeli, they're not supporters of Netanyahu, etc., etc., etc. Every single person, even the most fierce critic of Israel, ought to be ashamed by that and deeply concerned about it. There is no contradiction whatever. I worry that too many British political actors are inherently drawing a connection between Israel and British Jews, particularly in how they talk about the marches, and that that is actually creating a problem, making the problem for British Jews on a daily basis worse. And it was something that I wanted to explore yesterday with Helen Whateley, who's the Shadow Secretary of State for Work and Pensions from the Conservative Party.
They're not just peaceful protests, they are truly hate marches calling for the end of Israel.
You're saying that all the people on there are conducting hate?
I think what you see, if you see those marches...
Yeah, I've reported from them. I mean, you're saying these marches should be banned.
Yeah, so and marches in their own right are a process of radicalisation being involved in them. Of course, I'm not talking about every single person, but you have to overrule at the thing that is happening here. And we have to say in our
marches
society...
Marches are a process of radicalisation.
That is one of the things that can happen in a march. That is what is going on in our country, and we have to say this is not all right.
Would you be happy with, say, Tommy Robinson's marches, which included Elon Musk calling for the overthrow of our government? You're happy for that to go ahead?
I don't believe that Tommy Robinson here is talking about wanting to get rid of Israel and eradicate the Jewish people.
No, but that is a completely different thing. But at multiple demonstrations, not just his, but including Britain First rallies, for example, we've seen crowds chanting things like Allah is a paedophile, Muslim bombers off our street, signs reading stop Islam, ban Islam, or framing Islam as inherently violent or incompatible with Britain. Lots of Muslims would see that and think, that threatens me, should they be banned?
So I want a tolerant society, and I want people to be able to, you know, freely protest and express their views. But what I don't want is a situation where we start tolerating events which are basically calling for the eradication of the
They're
Jewish
calling
population.
For Muslims to be left to be deported from Britain.
Right.
Not everyone clearly at those marches for Gaza and Palestine would be racist. Clearly they wouldn't be. But you're saying that some of the people there are racist and are calling for violent, appalling things. So on the basis of that logic, you would ban Tommy Robinson's rally, because some of the people, not all the people there, are racist and calling for appalling things, but some people are.
Now, I've explained my position. It feels to me like we're going...
I don't understand it.
Well, it feels like we're going round and round in circles. So I don't see the benefit in going on as to one thing versus
another.
I'm
just wondering what the consistency is. That's all.
It is consistent. I'd say,
two calls for violence against two different groups.
Calling for a death to, you know, a group of people, that is not okay.
Ban Islam.
Not the right thing in
ban
country.
Islam. So ban Muslims, so basically. How is that? How is that not?
People,
how is that not?
It's not
really
okay.
Dangerous to a group of people when you're saying ban Islam.
I'm saying
ban Muslims from this country.
Calling for the death of a whole, you know, of people, of the Jewish people. That is not
so,
something.
So ban Judaism would be okay.
So what we're saying, I think you're going into hypotheticals. What about this? What about that? We've seen what's happened. What we've seen happen in this country is it become normalised that it is essentially okay to call for the end of Israel, and we don't agree with
some
that.
Muslims think, lots of Muslims think that hatred against them has become normalised.
I don't support hatred against, you know, any group of people. So there's a very specific thing that were happening. And look, we're seeing it in the rise of this huge rise of where we started this conversation in attacks against
Jewish
people.
Absolutely appalling.
Huge rise of anti-Semitism translating into violence, translating
we've
into people's lives.
We've also seen mosque attacks and so on. I mean, we've seen
people
hatred on the rise in every direction.
So, you know, let's not allow this kind of hatred. And there's a point at which you have to draw a line.
That's Helen Whateley, the Shadow Conservative Cabinet Minister, speaking to me yesterday. And look, that's the party line, and she was gamely defending it. But I don't think I got anywhere in trying to find a consistency here. And this is what I think is potentially dangerous. Because there is a perfectly legitimate case, and it can be had, that you want to ban these marches because you feel that they are becoming incubators of anti-Semitism. And I have reported from those marches, and I have absolutely heard anti-Semitic things said against them, at them, and I'm sure some people on them are anti-Semitic. It is also true to say that there are plenty of Jews on those marches, and there are plenty of people there who are not anti-Semitic, but they are very anti what the Israeli government are doing. But there are political forces in Britain now who seem to want to allied Israel and British Jewry. That itself is a form of anti-Semitism. That itself is a dangerous thing and has long been recognised as being a dangerous thing, as if British Jews ought to be somehow responsible for and associated with what Israel does or doesn't do. But that distinction doesn't seems to be almost entirely lost across large swathes of British politics right now. And even though there is a case you could make to ban them, as the Conservatives and others are now doing, then you have to answer the second part of the question, which is, OK, what is the criteria for banning them? And if you should ban them, should that criteria then be applied to other marches and other protests where racist things are done and said and where calls to violence are either explicitly or implicitly said? And if you're not applying that to other marches, if you have done to these marches which you feel are anti-Semitic, then why not? Why not? What is the logic? What is the narrative? What is the through line? And if you don't have it, if you don't have it, as I don't think we heard yesterday, and we didn't, I don't think, hear it from Kemi Badenoch either, if you don't have it, then what you're doing is you're creating the perception, fairly or unfairly, that you have a hierarchy of racism. And that itself is toxic to the very people that you are seeking, rightly, to defend against hate and prejudice, and of which they already experience far too much. So my question I want to put to you exactly is, what is the through line? If you think those marches should be banned, should other marches where hateful things are said and done, not by everybody, but by some people, should they be banned as well? And what is the line? What is the line? Because you do need criteria to do it. Otherwise, you're just banning marches in an arbitrary way. 0345-6060973. 0345-6060973. That hypocrisy, by the way, and I think there is so much hypocrisy in this, I don't think it's just confined to the right. Zach Polanski, who was also out and about yesterday, was asked by one interviewer, I think on the BBC, Laura Koonsberg on the BBC, whether or not he would ban the phrase globalise the intifada. And he said that policing people's language, he's not interested in that. And again, I think this can create the perception of potentially a damaging perception, because I think it's fair to say that the left, and others as well, I mean, in politics, people do police people's language. I mean, if at a far-right rally we were to hear offensive things with the N-word or the P-word or who knows what else, I think we would be interested in policing that language. I think that figures on the left, including potentially Zach Polanski, would be interested in policing that language. And I'm not saying that his position is wrong or illegitimate. But again, I am saying that there is often little consistency through this and about this, and that can create a damaging perception. I want your thoughts exactly on where we are now with these marches, and whether or not, if we're going to ban them, as Kemi Badenoch wants, then surely we're going to have to ban others, because exactly the same things could be said. As I said to Helen Waitley, there is a through line of logic. Not everyone will be racist or saying bad things there, but if some people are, then using that logic, then you would ban all marches where any bad things, any calls to violence, any racism, sustained racism, is heard, wouldn't you? And if not, why not? 0345 6060 973. A little bit of breaking news again. Senior Iranian official to Reuters denying what the US has said, saying Iran fired a warning shot against a US warship to prevent its entry into the Strait of Hormuz. So that line from the Iranians appears to have changed. They initially said two missiles. Now they're saying a warning shot. Unclear as to whether there was any damage. The fog of war just got a little bit thicker. Times 12:16.
LBC.
You've probably been with the same energy supplier for decades. And why wouldn't you be? Loyalty matters. But lately, bigger hasn't always felt better. You've probably dealt with long waits and endless automated menus in search of someone who can actually help. Octopus Energy is now Britain's biggest energy supplier, trusted by over 8 million customers, because we do things differently. Our people focus on the most important thing, you. When you call, you'll speak to a real person. No robotic scripts, no computer says no. Just an honest conversation with someone who actually wants to help. Join the millions who've already made the move. Octopus Energy, recommended by Which, a record 9 years running. Visit octopus.energy/better for verification.
Ready for a new kitchen? Wix Kitchen Experts can support you with clever designs and a professional installation. Book your free kitchen design appointment at Wix.
Switching to Vodafone full fibre broadband is now as easy as pie. Ooh, freshly baked. It's a walk in the park. Hello, little fella. It's like taking candy from a baby. Come on, as if I'd do that. With One Touch Switch, it's easy. We sort everything out for you. We even contact your current provider. Plus, we'll help towards leaving fees. Switch today to full fibre broadband with Vodafone.
Up to £200 credit to cover leaving fees. More information and terms at vodafone.co.uk/broadband.
For whoever they want to be in life, give them a great start with WellKid. Carefully balanced, great-tasting vitamins and minerals for 4 to 12-year-olds with specific nutrients such as zinc and vitamin D, which support normal immune system function. The WellKid range from Vitabiotics, from Boots, pharmacies and Vitabiotics.com.
Octopus Energy. Great value and outstanding customer service. Recommended by Which? A record 9 years running.
Lewis Goodall on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Time is 12:18. We're talking about where the line should be in terms of banning marches. The Conservative Party wants to ban the marches they call hate marches. They say that they are radicalising forces within themselves against Israel, but they don't seem to be so keen to ban, for example, far-right marches, some of which are coming up later this month. Paul is in Twickenham. Paul, good afternoon. What's your thoughts on this?
Good afternoon. There's two points for this. First of all, the marches themselves, I think they should be allowed to continue, but a much heavier police presence to arrest anyone calling out chants that could easily and naturally be interpreted as encouraging hatred or violence towards Jewish people.
Yes.
And that could be done, Lewis, by withdrawing the massive unnecessary policing of Palestine Action Group protests where 60 and 70-year-old ladies and vicars are picked up by the arms and legs and taken to vans. My second point, Lewis, is about an argument I've heard so many times on LBC from various speakers, guests you invite in, and they say, why are there no protests against what Iran is doing? Why are there no protests against what's going on in Sudan? Why is it that it's only Israel that attracts these marches? And the answer appears to me to be this, Lewis. The British government armed Israel, and I've watched Parliament for the last 2 years very closely. It refuses to engage and condemn in any constructive way with the atrocities that Israel carries out, just as it should also engage with the atrocities Hamas carries out.
I also think, Paul,
the British government has denied, so long as the British government fails to speak honestly about the errors of the Netanyahu government, the marches will continue.
Yeah.
The reason there's no marches against Sudan or Iran, it's because no one is denying what is going on there,
yeah,
and no one is arming the Sudanese government or the Iranian government.
Well,
as far as the British government is concerned, we are arming Israel,
yes,
and we are refusing to condemn when they commit atrocities, although we're happy to naturally and rightly condemn when Hamas or some other group commits an atrocity. That is why the marches should continue, because the government could do the heavy lifting here, take the pressure off the Jewish community by simply speaking out as a reliable friend against Israel. I think it says somewhere in the Hebrew scriptures, the person who refuses to speak frankly to his neighbour when he's in a fault shares his guilt. We need to be doing that. The government has taken a milksop approach to what the,
well, Paul,
what
just
the
to say,
IDF
Paul,
and
Paul,
the
Paul, 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 sure. Well, just to say, I mean, our arms shipments to Israel are very limited by comparison, but I think you're absolutely right to say that that is a factor. I also think, I just also don't really think that anyone has the right to tell people what to care about. I mean, there will be people who will be motivated by anti-Semitic intent, I'm sure, with how they feel about Israel. I'm sure that's true. But do we really believe that the, I mean, it will be millions of people, especially younger people, we can see that from the polling, but the millions of people who are deeply concerned about what's happened in Israel and Gaza and so on, do we really believe that they are all motivated by anti-Semitic intent? Surely not. And secondly, as I say, I'm not sure that anyone in particular has the right to tell people what particular political causes they care about. I mean, by definition, everybody who has politics cares about some things more than others for a whole multitude of reasons, and it's not really for anybody else to tell them that it's not legitimate, the order in which they care about things.
Well, I quite agree with you, Lewis, but as I say, the one thing that's coming across to me more and more clearly as I reflect on why these marches continue is the fact that for the last... I've watched them in Parliament, the imitation hand-wringing, the refusal to stop sending parts for F-35s, the weaselly excuses made, the flimsy saying, oh, we're engaging with our partners to tackle Israel.
Well, to be fair, Paul, we should say as well, to be fair, Paul, we should say as well, I mean, there is a legitimate argument to be had about the fact that, you know, Israel, yes, it has engaged in, you know, offensive military operations, they say, to protect themselves, but they are surrounded by groups that do want to destroy them, and we certainly don't want to see the UK, Israelis, innocent Israeli civilians killed. So there is a legitimate argument to be had about to what extent the UK should support Israel in its defensive capabilities. That's legitimate.
Yes, absolutely, Lewis. I'm certainly not calling for Israel to be overwhelmed. I'm simply saying that I've watched the front bench, not the back benchers, the Labour back benchers generally have spoken out against wrongdoing, wherever it's come from. But the government front bench for the last 2 years has given a performative account of what's going on, objection to what Israel in some parts of its approach has been doing wrong. And that is backed up, Lewis, by the wonderful program that was on a few months ago about quite a few members who've been conscripted into the IDF or served in the IDF and rejected what they were seeing in certain
ITV,
cases. And also the letter from the board, some members of the Board of Deputies of British Jews, about 40 of them, I think, out of 400, something like that, who said Israel is destroying its soul doing this. Now, those deputies, I understand, have been sort of kicked off the board, but the government could help the Jewish community of this country by, without fear or favour, speaking out against the atrocities by Hamas or whoever it is, or by the Myanmar government, or by the Sudanese rebels, and also call to account where Israel plainly fails to respect the United Nations Charter, to respect human rights, to engage in the Gazification of Lebanon, which is now going on.
All right, Paul. Grateful to you. Okay, Paul. Plenty to say, I think it's fair to say, and that's what we like to hear. But I mean, absolutely right to say, and I would certainly agree with him, policing them more, and I disagree with Polanski. I think globalised intifada at this point is clearly being interpreted and it's clearly being interpreted by some as a call to violence against Jews, and I'm not sure why anybody needs to say it. I know it's got a particular history. Before I get all the texts explained to me, I know the history of it, I know where it comes from, I know its pedigree. Sometimes perception matters more than historical pedigree, and I think that would be a reasonable compromise to make, not least because many of those people on those marches would usually be the first to say the perception with regards to racism really matters. So it would be a legitimate and pleasant thing to do, a civilised thing to do, simply not to say those things which so many Jews find scary. It seemed to me a reasonable compromise position. Phil is in Broadstairs. Phil, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Lewis. Great to talk to you.
To you.
I think there are two things that I picked up from you, and one is inconsistency and the other is possibly the notion of, from conversation, of complicity. But the issue I wanted to make a point about was that I believe in being against all forms of racism and discrimination. I've gone on protests against homophobic attacks when friends of mine have been attacked for their on gay pride marches. I've noticed that the Islamophobic attacks are also going on, and I would draw your attention gently to the fact that the hue and cry about the what has happened in quite rightly in Golders Green has not been echoed by what happened in Southwark, where a Muslim man was attacked by this gentleman before he set about attacking the people in Golders Green. This is this has received hardly any of the same degree of condemnation.
Well, where do you think, Paul, just to drag back to think, where do you think that the line should be in terms of prohibiting the prohibition of marches?
Well, I absolutely oppose that, and that's because unless people who want to propose the banning of marches are going to make their case, as I've said, against all discrimination, and I'm adding another plank to it, which would be they must call out the genocide in Gaza. Now, if we all agree that there has been what has gone on in Gaza is atrocious, if we're going to sit on our hands and keep silent about that, those marches are going to have to continue, and I will continue to go on them. Because as far as I'm concerned, my duty as a citizen here is to point out what my government should be doing, and that is calling out the genocide, and they have not done that. They've gone along with it, and I agree with the previous caller on that. Even supplying F-35 parts and helping with detailed reconnaissance flights from Cyprus, pointing out where possible targets might be to the IDF, is also unacceptable, because that is complicity.
But what if they're, for example, being attacked by Hezbollah? Surely we would assist the Israelis to defend their civilians against Hezbollah.
Well, if Hezbollah are attacking Israel, Israel has the right to respond to that. It does not have the right to blow up, to kill journalists, to kill medical personnel, to blow up hospitals, to demolish flats with 370 people in them just to kill one Hezbollah person. What they did with what they're doing in Lebanon, Lewis, is rolling out the Gaza approach into Lebanon. I mean, it's an absolute disgrace. Right. And I agree with the previous speaker, because if we are going to call ourselves helpful friends of Israel, then we surely have to be the ones to say, I'm sorry, we call you out for your genocide. And Starmer didn't do that, and he made the mistake right at the beginning, Lewis.
He did recognise Palestine.
The state is one thing. Calling for the cutting off of water and electricity, which he did at the beginning, and so did Emily Thornberry, and then taking a week to apologise. I think of that when I hear Jack Polansky being jumped on, quite rightly.
All right, Phil in Broadstairs there should say, of course, Israel continues to deny the idea that he's perpetrated a genocide. Other international bodies and charities vehemently disagree. We'll continue this conversation throughout the course of the rest of the next half hour, as well as keeping an eye on what is going on in Iran as well, in the Strait of Hormuz. I do think that there seems to be, with regards to these marches, I mean, one of the ironies is that if the Conservative Party wants to ban pro-Palestine Gaza marches because there is anti-Semitic things said, but again, that logic, I didn't have time to put it to Helen Waitley, but then you would ban the far-right marches which take place from time to time, because guess what? There is loads of anti-Semitic stuff on there, and there always have been. There always has been. I mean, you know, there are certain figures pretending to be great friends of the Jewish people in Israel at the moment. I mean, perhaps they are, but there are lots of people who are associated with the far right, and certainly if you go to report from far right rallies, it won't take long before you see some anti-Semitic tropes or you see anti-Semitic things said. And so on that basis, why wouldn't you ban those as well? And this is the thing about banning marches. You very, very quickly get into a slippery, slippery slope, and it's not clear where the consistency is, and I haven't heard it so far. Can you provide it to me? 0345 6060 973. Time is 12:30. Let's get the latest LBC News headlines now with Lucinda Horsley.
The US is denying claims by Iran that it's hit an American warship with two missiles in the Strait of Hormuz. Donald Trump earlier promised to free stranded vessels along the key shipping route in a humanitarian gesture. The World Health Organization says the risk to the wider public from a hantavirus outbreak on a cruise ship remains low. Three people have died and a British man's in hospital in South Africa. The King said to be delighted after Princess Eugenie announced she's pregnant with her third child. She already has two sons, August and Ernest, with husband James Brooksbank. LBC weather: showers for southern England, south Wales and northern Scotland. Brighter for southern Scotland, but mostly cloudy elsewhere, a high of 19 degrees.
This is LBC.
Switching to Vodafone full fibre broadband is now as easy as pie. Ooh, freshly baked. It's a walk in the park. Hello, little fella. It's like taking candy from a baby. Come on, as if I'd do that. With One Touch Switch, it's easy. We sort everything out for you. We even contact your current provider. Plus, we'll help towards leaving fees. Switch today to full fibre broadband with Vodafone.
Up to £200 credit to cover leaving fees. More information and terms at vodafone.co.uk/broadband.
Amazon offers term time working to their employees, like Anton, who's home to look after his daughters during their holidays.
Hello!
To him, this is the best sound in the world. Actually, maybe that's the best sound of all. Now that's term time working. Offered at Amazon. 10 weeks off guaranteed per year. Mix of paid holiday and unpaid time off. Conditions apply.
Shine Night Walk London is a 10K, half marathon or full marathon supported walk around the city at night on the 19th of September to raise vital money for Cancer Research UK. It's also...
everyone walking with all their colours, twinkling away.
We can actually see how nice London is. And London is different at night time.
Celebration of life, and it gives hope.
Step towards a brighter future at shinewalk.org today to get 30% off your entry. Together, we are beating cancer. T's and C's apply.
Noticed a change in your hearing? Well, get a hearing check from Specsavers. Oh, not sure where to start? Well, we're very flexible. Book one online, on the phone, on your lunch break, on Saturdays, on the same day if you're lucky. Oh, you only miss the odd word. But what if the odd words you're missing are nice ones like love you, or important ones like duck? Oh, too expensive, is it? All right, we like you. We'll do it for nothing. For free hearing checks... should have gone to Specsavers.
Lewis Goodall on LBC. Text 84850.
Time is 12:33. We're discussing where the line ought to be when you're talking about banning, prohibiting rallies because they are spread, or rallies or marches because they are spreading hatred. The Conservative Party thinks that the rallies that we see against what the Israeli government has been doing in Gaza have become incubators of anti-Semitism. But of course, plenty of other rallies and plenty of other marches have a lot of hateful things on them. It doesn't mean to say that every single person on them believes in those things. I thought it was pretty ridiculous when we saw the Prime Minister also sort of getting in on this at the end of last week, obviously understandably wanting to draw attention to the appalling plight that Jews feel in this country, increasingly that they are under attack. Indeed, they are under attack. We saw what happened with Manchester Synagogue, 2025, appalling number of anti-Semitic incidents and so on. But in his saying, the Prime Minister, that if you're standing next to someone on a march and they say, shout, globalise the Intifada, he said that you are calling for terrorism against Jews and just standing next to someone in that situation. Now, I happen to think that it would be entirely legitimate, for reasons I've set out, to consider the chant, globalise the Intifada, a hate crime or calling for incitement to violence against Jews. Perfectly willing to consider that, but we cannot be considered guilty of something just because... the same thing, just because you're standing next to someone at a march who says something about which you might entirely disagree. Where on earth does that end? The law can't just be applied indiscriminately in this way or just because we feel like it. It has to have some beginning and end. It has to have some consistency. It has to have some rationality and reason and logic. And right now, from the major British political parties, I hear almost none. Gurdip is in Wakefield, who has something to say about the marches. Gurdip.
Yeah, hi, Lewis. Thanks for the call. Good afternoon. I think the conflation or the perception presented by a lot of media and a lot of shows actually on LBC as well, other than the James O'Brien and your show this morning, that basically these marches are hate or these marches are threatening to British Jews or targeting British Jews or against British Jews or any kind of Jews is false. I think in the same way that people marched against Vietnam or Iraq, people are marching against war and genocide.
There are anti-Semitic elements, there aren't there, Gurdip. I mean, I've reported from them myself and I've seen it myself. There is either a sort of quite casual anti-Semitism that can creep in or explicit. I mean, that is by no means to say that it's everybody or even the majority or anything like it, but it is there.
But how come we're not... Why are we not seeing that kind of bad side of that person coming out where they're being anti-Semitic? Why are we not blaming the Zionist approach, the genocide for that? Why are we just automatically...
Well, because I don't think... Well, yeah, whoa. I think we start getting into a dangerous game when we start saying, well, they're racist because of those people. Like, we don't need to start justifying it. If you're racist and you've got anti-Semitism, there's no excuse as to why you might be. You're just racist. That's it.
Well, I think, it's good that you use the word racist there, because I sometimes wonder why is racism against Jews called anti-Semitism? Maybe
the dangerous thing about your logic is that using your logic would say, well, people don't like Muslims, you know, because of terrorism. They don't like it because they see Islamic terrorism, so they don't like Muslims. You see, it's dangerous. You can't do that.
No, I'm not doing that. I'm just saying, in the same way, if you're actually against a war and you're marching, you're going out to march against war, you're actually against another person of a different colour in a different country being genocided.
But you did say that, Gerda. You did say that because you said that, why aren't we talking, if people are anti-Semitic, why aren't we talking about the genocide that's happened, that you said it's happened in Israel, i.e. there's a cause and effect. And my contention to you is that is a very dangerous road to go down, because as soon as you start talking about and giving sort of explanatory notes as to why someone is racist, then you can start applying that to all manner of things, and it's dangerous.
It could be dangerous, but why is this cholera, why is this anti-Semitism rise happening at the same time as a war this genocide against these people?
Well, in a sense, it doesn't matter.
Why wasn't
because
it happening in 2018 any other year?
Well, we did talk about anti-Semitism quite a lot in 2018 during the Jeremy Corbyn leadership of the Labour Party, but there is, I think it doesn't matter. Yes, of course, we can look at different elements and you can sort of say there are structural factors here, there, but ultimately, if you think, as I do, that British Jews should not and cannot be adjudged to be responsible or linked to what the State of Israel does because they're not Israeli, they are British Jews. And even if you are Israeli, you might not agree with what the Netanyahu government is doing. Given, if you think that, then in a sense it doesn't matter what Israel is doing. We should just find it absolutely appalling that there is an increase in anti-Semitic incidents in the UK.
That's my point. I said I don't think these marches are against British Jews. I don't think they're targeting those people at all.
But we are seeing a rise in anti-Semitism in Britain.
The marches actually include lots of British Jews, as you said, and Zach Polanski, and these people are actually talking in favour of these marches. I mean, to actually call them hate when actually they're trying to... I mean, the only thing they hate is genocide, if you want to really class them as hate. They're hating the war, they're hating the genocide.
Gerdy in Wakefield, grateful to you. Netanyahu's been conflating Jewish people with anti-Semitism for years, says Dale. And that is absolutely true. And we can see for his political purposes why he might wish to do that. I think it's dangerous when we see British political actors doing the same thing. And that conflation between Israel and British Jews actually against the IHRA's definition of anti-Semitism. Not that you would know it from the way that quite a bit of the media and political players talk about it. Ian is in Watford. Ian, good afternoon.
Hi. Two aspects. The first was a very simple question to you, Lewis.
Yes, okay. I'll do my best.
All the marches over the last 20-odd years, have any of them achieved anything? I'll give you an hour or two to think about it.
Well, I think you could say, for example, the poll tax marches / riots were pretty instrumental in actually delegitimizing and bringing Margaret Thatcher down. I think
because
you could say
it was stupid. You're quite right. That's probably the only one, because there was something that could be done about it.
Yes.
And actually the realization that it was stupid, it's much easier to build a building than it is to build people, because people move and buildings don't.
Yes. Go on. And your point is?
But the idea of the marches is I don't know exactly how much it's costing this country, either in the sense that people are not contributing to the economy, spending money or doing things. The cost of policing it must be astronomical over the period of time. And as it hasn't achieved much. There can be much more achieved in possibly educating people to understand why the situation is in Israel.
But I suppose, Ian, on that basis, we wouldn't allow any marches at all. And ultimately, in a democracy, you know, we have freedom of assembly. And even if they don't yield very much or they don't translate into much, and there will be a handful that do, and perhaps you're right, most don't. Ultimately, that is people's choice as to how they spend their time. It isn't for the state to turn around and go, well, this isn't going to achieve anything, so you can go away.
Well, I think that you can do it on a smaller basis. You can write letters to your MP. You've got MPs. Everybody write a letter to their MPs, things like that.
Well, that definitely doesn't achieve anything.
I don't know. But what I'm saying is, the one thing I do know is that it actually has not achieved. I mean, the biggest march was the one against the war in Iraq.
Indeed.
Right? Which was millions of people virtually.
Yeah,
and it achieved nothing. So there must be another way.
But they do affect politics, though. And I mean, I don't know if I completely agree with you. I mean, very often the outcome, you're right, takes time or it might never happen. But marches do affect the dynamics of day-to-day politics. For example, I doubt if we hadn't seen the number of marches and volume that we've seen over the past 2 years and so on, which has been sending a signal to the Starmer government that quite a bit of their base of support is dissatisfied with their policy. I doubt that Starmer and the Labour government would have recognised Palestine. So there are all sorts of indirect effects on our politics to marches and demonstrations.
Well, you're quite right about the business of recognising Palestine, which the Palestinian Authority had a very good deal a number of years ago where they had 95%.
The Clinton proposals.
Yes, they turned it down. And of course, what a lot of people don't know is Yasser Arafat, who was the so-called representative, became a billionaire on the back of all the money that went into the Palestinian Authority. The people of Palestine have been robbed of a life by those people who manipulate, some of it coming from Iran, who want to see Israel wiped off the mat, the face of the planet. They've said it categorically, and Jews. So that is your cause. And as much as I don't agree with Trump, there is a point to be had there. And if you lived in Israel, I don't, but if... And you had rockets coming into you.
Yeah, of course.
There would be people complaining in this country rockets. And so, it's the manipulation of news which bothers me. It's all the dramatized. I mean, Hamas have.
Well, I mean, I would say, I mean, just to push back, just to push slightly. I mean, I completely agree with you, and it is too often missed in the conversation. Of course, you know, many Israelis living alongside or very close to people who would wish to kill them. We saw that play out in the most graphic, appalling, heinous way on October 7th. And Israel, of course, has a right to defend itself. But I think it's fair to say, when you say news has been dramatic or over-dramatised, I mean, what has happened in Gaza and is now happening in southern Lebanon, that is quite dramatic, isn't it? I mean, we've literally seen 90% of Gaza destroyed.
I agree. I would be very much against that. That should have been an opportunity for Israel to say, this is who we're dealing with. How would you deal with it? But in the case of Lebanon, what other country in the world has got another army completely free of action to do what it likes within its own country?
Well, and the Lebanese government would very much like to do something about it, but it's too weak. Ian is in Watford. Kate is also in Watford. Watford special. Kate,
I am.
Good afternoon.
Yes. Good afternoon. I just wanted to say something that's been bugging me for a long time. I listen to LBC a lot.
Please do.
I'm a European Jew, and I haven't been able to say that I was Jewish. Actually, up until recently, I decided, blur, I'm just going to go with it and just say what I am. But when I was younger, I was 12, 13, I was being chased down from the youth club. People named that because being Jewish was worse. And so and I just can't describe to you what it's like having to hide your personality. Like my aunt's a rabbi, my uncle happens to be, not my own, my cousin, sorry, happens to be a rabbi as well. And so it's not like we're not Jewish, but... my grandparents came over in the Holocaust, and why should we, you know, have to live this over and over and over and over?
It's okay.
Beyond.
And what do you think, Kate? I totally understand. What do you think, Kate? If you had to sort of encapsulate it, that non-Jews don't understand, how would you encapsulate it? What would you say?
I'd say that not every Jew is a Zionist.
No.
And Zionist is a very, it's a word that's
loaded
become,
term.
Yes, that's the word I'm looking for.
Or it's become so, yes.
And so it's got to the point where I have to say I'm not a Zionist just because I don't want to go to Israel. But that doesn't mean that I don't love the country and I don't agree with what they're doing. But automatically people think, as soon as I say I'm Jewish, that that's it, that I agree with everything that's being done by Netanyahu and all these other people. And I don't. I just want to live my life in peace. Like my grandparents, they worked so hard for this country. My granddad, he you know, was in the army, fought for the British, he took Berlin. You know, my you'd never know that they went Jewish if you met them on the street. But this is how we have to hide. And people just don't get that.
Kate, in Watford, sorry. I'm great. No, don't apologise, please. I completely understand, or at least I hope I understand. Grateful to you, and I think it's really important that we often do this. And this is exactly why I think it's so dangerous for British politicians and media figures to somehow equate criticism of Israel as somehow being inherently against British Jews. That is not to say that everybody who criticises Israel is not anti-Semitic. I'm sure, in fact I know, some of them are. It is not to say that rising anti-Semitism, casual and otherwise, violent anti-Semitism, is not a rising problem that needs, ought, has to be dealt with. It is a cancer. But to equate, as so many politicians and media figures now blithely do, just casually do, the idea that criticising Israel is somehow inexorably going to lead to more anti-Semitism, or is just sort of covered or coated anti-Semitism, is really dangerous, because it implies that Israel and British Jews are the same thing, and they are not. That is literally an anti-Semitic trope, and yet it is one in which it feels to me half the time that half of the British media and half of the British politics seem to willingly fall into. Failing to distinguish and make the difference, as if, and the dead problem with that is it's sending out the signal that somehow British Jewry ought to be responsible and should be responsible or treated as the same thing as Israel. And that way lies ruin. That way lies more anti-Semitism. It is truly, truly, truly bizarre. And I think worse than bizarre. It's sinister and is often committed by people who haven't thought about it enough. We're going to be talking to Simon Marks, RBC's Washington correspondent, just in a minute or two about this, trying to sort of pass our way through that fog of war as to what's been happening in the Strait of Hormuz this morning, and indeed Donald Trump's latest broadsides against Europe. That's coming up. Time is 12:49.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Sheila Fogarty.
Unconfirmed reports Iran has bombed a US destroyer. What now for global shipping and your prices? Good protest, bad protest, ban, no ban. Where is the line? And Nigel Farage's 5 million.
Sheila Fogarty at 1. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
When you're smiling, when you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you.
Life feels better with a smile. Banning Dental Group Clinics. Modern, comfortable and affordable dentistry for all. See online for our price match promise. Keep on smiling.
Keep on smiling, keep on smiling, and the whole world smiles with you.
Banningdental.co.uk.
Fever Tree Ginger Beer. There's no one quite like you, is there? That fiery character. Warming undertones. Mixed, you make a spirited Moscow Mule. But even on your own, you still have the most delectable kick. Fever Tree. Straight up or mixed. It's a matter of taste.
What's the best present you ever got for your birthday? I bet it wasn't as life-changing as £1 million. Every week with the birthday draw, there's £1 million to be won. And you can enter from as little as £1 or via post. Enter by midnight on Sunday and your special day could win you £1 million. Visit thebirthdaydraw.com. Is it your lucky day? From Global and ITV. 18 plus UK only, no purchase necessary.
Ready for a new kitchen? Wix kitchen experts can support you with clever designs and a professional installation. Book your free kitchen design appointment at Wix.
Craving a little sunshine? Virgin Atlantic Holidays has the answer. This is your sign to high-five a superhero before breakfast in Florida. Or rainforest trek to hidden waterfalls in the Caribbean. Or step off your pier into the bluest of blue water in the Maldives. With Flying Club, save up to £300 this bank holiday weekend. Book in store, over the phone or online at Virgin Atlantic Holidays. Select routes. For T's and C's, visit virginatlantic.com. Atil protected.
Leading Britain's conversation, LBC, with Lewis Goodall.
Time is 12:51. Well, it has been quite the morning in the latest sort of series of episodes between Iran and the US. Episodes feels appropriate with Trump, doesn't it? Donald Trump, or the Trump administration, denying via Axios, an American media organization, that earlier Iranian reports, according to the Iranian state news agency, that a US warship had turned around after being hit by two Iranian missiles. Iranians now saying that a warning shot was fired. Let's get the latest from Simon Marks, the great Simon Marks, LBC's Washington correspondent, joining us from the US Capitol. Simon, what is going on here? We've had Project Freedom, so-called, which Trump announced overnight. Trump says that he wants to go and rescue the stranded mariners who are in the strait. Then Iran apparently hits missiles. The US is rejecting the claims. What is going on?
Well, you mentioned the fog of war, Lewis. We are navigating a pea super in the Strait of Hormuz today. Iranian state media announced that a US warship, they did not name it, had been struck by two missiles as it tried to enter the Strait of Hormuz, and they said that the warship had then turned around and retreated. The Americans now say that is flatly untrue. We've had a statement from US Central Command saying no US Navy ships have been struck. US forces are supporting Project Freedom, I'll get to that in a moment, and enforcing the naval blockade on Iranian ports. What that statement notably does not address is whether a US warship was targeted by Iranian missiles that may not actually have struck it, and it certainly doesn't address the Iranian claim that a US warship turned around and retreated in the aftermath of whatever took place at the entrance to the Strait of Hormuz. Meanwhile, the United Arab Emirates says that a tanker affiliated with its state-owned oil company ADNOC has been struck in the Strait of Hormuz. Of course, we are dealing still with the chaos that was created last night by President Trump's claim of the beginning of what he is calling Project Freedom, which he characterized on social media as a humanitarian effort by the U.S. Navy to assist crews, sailors and others that are aboard all of those stranded vessels that cannot transit through the Strait of Hormuz because of the U.S. naval blockade. He says that conditions aboard those vessels are getting increasingly dire. Food is running out. Water is running out. Unsanitary conditions are developing. And therefore, in an act of great magnanimity, the United States was going to launch this Project Freedom to help those vessels get through the Strait of Hormuz, which raised all sorts of questions about what exactly he was talking about. The White House then scrambled to clarify that he was not saying the U.S. Navy was going to escort those vessels through the strait. He was simply saying that the U.S. Navy would be guiding those vessels. In other words, providing them with information about how they might themselves seek to transit the Strait of Hormuz safely. But ultimately, of course, the risk of would have been entirely with the captains of those vessels. So not surprisingly, there have not been very many volunteers leaping up to take advantage of Operation Project Freedom, the most interesting aspect of which may well be the name. Because remember, Donald Trump was facing a 60-day clock that was ran out on Friday night to seek congressional authorization for Operation Epic Freedom. The White House says there's no need to seek that authorization because hostilities terminated on April the 7th when the ceasefire came into force. To all intents and purposes, the White House is claiming with a straight face that Operation Epic Freedom is either paused or has come to an end. And there is a possibility here that what the White House ultimately seeks to do is restart hostilities, give it all a new coat of paint, give it a fresh name, and then say to Congress, so that 60-day clock starts from zero again now, which, of course, many lawmakers would argue is being too cute by half.
And I think what we can say, although it's, as you say, the fog of war remains thick, Simon, I think what we can say is if there is any, even a smidgen of truth whatsoever, even if it is just a warning shot, which the Iranians are now saying, if it is true that a US naval ship turned around. Maybe the Americans won't admit to it. Who knows? But, I mean, there can be no doubt, I think, that Trump is going to consider that to be embarrassing and an escalation from his point of view.
Well, it certainly plays into the argument of Chancellor Friedrich Merz of Germany that Iran has humiliated the United States and potentially is continuing to do so. I mean, the president's official position, the official White House position, is that this war is being won on a daily basis, that Iran has been completely neutered. It, as the president repeats like a mantra, it has no navy, it has no air force, it has no anti-ballistic missile capability left. And yet the Iranians, whatever happened in the strait today, certainly they've struck a UAE tanker in the strait. They still have the heft available, and Pentagon officials have conceded in classified briefings for lawmakers, thousands of ballistic missiles and drones at their disposal to keep the Strait of Hormuz essentially closed. And the Iranians have within the last couple of hours said they will open fire on any vessel that seeks to make its way through the strategic waterway. So this standoff is by no means over. The Americans rejected the latest 14-point peace proposals that Iran furnished over the weekend. They didn't address the nuclear issue at all. There was never any chance the Americans were going to embrace them. President Trump said in his Truth Social posting that talks with the Iranians are going well. I mean, there is no evidence to support that claim, as he continues to threaten a resumption of hostilities.
And very briefly, Simon, we should say, what do you make over the weekend of Trump's latest withdrawal of 5,000 American troops from Germany? You've mentioned the Merz spats that they've been having. Americans have been withdrawing troops previously. What do you make of how Trump has announced this?
Well, he said on Saturday that he's going to go even further than the 5,000 troop withdrawals, that he's going to go a lot further in cutting back the American military presence in Germany, a total of 36,000 American active duty personnel that are permanently based in Germany. That clearly deeply unnerves European leaders. It is exactly what you would be doing if you were planning ultimately to pull the United States out of NATO. He's got the pledges to withdraw American troops also from Italy and Spain, both of them on the naughty step here as well. So it just deepens the tensions across the Atlantic.
That's Simon Marks there, LBC's Washington correspondent. And that brings us to an end. We are out of time for today. If you missed any of today's show, of course, you can listen back on our free Global Player app for the and the LBC app, where you can also stay up to date with the latest news, videos and opinion. Download the official LBC app for free from your app store now. I will be back from 10 p.m. on Thursday night for election night. Does it get any better than that, ladies and gentlemen? What is it? Three more sleeps now? Cannot wait. Christmas has come early. Going to be a momentous night in British politics. Join me from 10 on Thursday, coming up at 4 on LBC Today. It is Henry Riley. We can't get rid of him, but now it's time for Sheila Fogarty.
I got confused when you said that then. Thank you very much indeed, Lewis. Yeah, very exciting times ahead later in the week, aren't there? We'll all be there. At 3 today, an undeclared £5 million loan, which Nigel Farage says was for his security. Why is our political funding generally such a mess and so prone to error? At 2, the possible banning of pro-Palestinian marches even temporarily begs a few important questions. I know you were talking about them with Lewis earlier in his programme. Not least, why certain other bans don't happen, why certain other protests do get to go ahead. But we're going to start with those unconfirmed reports that Iran has bombed a US destroyer. Whatever has happened, we know that this is dragging on and it's going to mean a great deal of economic problem for the whole globe.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock. The US has denied one of its warships has been hit by two Iranian missiles in the Strait of Hormuz. Donald Trump earlier said American forces would start to aid stranded ships out of the vital passage. The US president claims it's a humanitarian gesture as crews and vessels continue to be blocked by Tehran. Military analyst Sean Bell has more.
When they say missiles rather than drones, it might be these anti-ship missiles. They could be quite serious. But we also understand from the Iranian statement that actually both these warships turned away. Well, that would imply that they weren't disabled, and therefore it could well be they're simply warning shots.
The World Health Organization says the risk to the wider public following a hantavirus outbreak on a cruise ship remains low. Three people have died while a British man is in hospital in South Africa after falling ill on the MV Hondius. The disease is typically spread by rodents. Sir Keir Starmer told EU leaders he wants to strengthen ties with the bloc and ensure Ukraine can continue to fight Russia. The Prime Minister's joined a meeting in Armenia aimed at loaning Kyiv £78 billion over 2 years. Lord Ricketts, former permanent secretary for the Foreign Office, has told LBC it's becoming clearer the UK should align closer to Europe.
The balance has shifted. Donald Trump doesn't care at all for alliances, and we've got to adjust to take that into account. And we've got to make do with less American personnel, less American commanders, less American kit in Europe. The trick, I think, is to try and make sure they don't pull it down so fast. We haven't got time to build up a European substitute.
An area in Bristol has now been declared safe following an explosion at a house killing two people. Three others, including a child, were also taken to hospital yesterday. Buckingham Palace says the King's delighted there'll be a new addition to the family. Princess Eugenie and her husband Jack Brooksbank are expecting a third child later this year. LBC weather: showers for southern England, South Wales and northern Scotland. Brighter for southern Scotland, but mostly cloudy elsewhere. A high of 19 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Lucinda Horsley.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Sheila Fogarty.
Hello there, good afternoon to you. Interesting to hear just at the tail end there of Lewis Goodall's programme that this confused picture continues in the Strait of Hormuz about these claims that Iran had bombed one way or another an American destroyer. This comes hours after Donald Trump said the US would help stranded ships out of the waterway. He said it was a humanitarian action, not a military one. You can kind of understand why Iran might be sceptical about that. And they immediately said that they would stop any ships from operating, any American military ships from operating in the area. It's still very unclear as to whether that has already amounted to an attack. There are claims and counterclaims, the US military itself denying a claim made by Iranian state media that Iran hit an American warship trying to enter the Strait of Hormuz. We'll get some thoughts on this in just a moment from Tim Marshall, foreign affairs analyst and author of Prisoners of Geography. Well, the sailors on board those ships are very much prisoners of geography at the moment, aren't they? What's obvious, though, what's clear now, is that this is going on and on. It is far from clear that we're going to get a solution quickly or soon to the situation in Iran, the situation with the shipping, which obviously has much wider impact around the world, not least on our own economy. We'll be talking about threat to food prices a little later in the programme. But on the question of what's going on in the Strait of Hormuz and what we can expect perhaps a little later in the day, Tim Marshall joins me. Tim, hi, thanks for joining us today.
Hello, Sheila.
How likely is it that Iran has fired a missile at a US destroyer?
Oh, I think it's possible they've fired a missile. I think it's highly unlikely they've actually hit two American ships for a number of reasons. One, they'd have to be pretty daft to do that. Two, if they had done, because this was several hours ago, allegedly, by now there would have been multiple airstrikes against Iran. There's no way in hell, if two American ships had been hit, the Americans would not have retaliated with overwhelming force. So, you know, never say never, but I do not believe it. They may well have fired warning shots in the vicinity of, precisely to send the message to the Americans and to President Trump, that if he's going to try and implement this Project Freedom to get the ships out, or at least to resupply them, then they will have something to say about that.
And the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, has said that a tanker affiliated with its state-owned oil company, ADNOC, has been hit in the Strait of Hormuz. So clearly missiles are flying.
Yeah. That's more plausible, especially if the UAE has said it. That's more plausible. And in fact, there was an attack, I think, yesterday, and there was an attack by the small Iranian fast boats, I think, on Friday against ships. I mean, 10 sailors have died during this crisis, and there's been about 27 ships hit. But, you know, that is a different thing to actually hitting two American warships. So I think we can park that for the moment. But again, hitting ships, again, would be another message. Trump's Project Freedom is that apparently there's going to be 100 aeroplanes and 15,000 personnel and dozens of ships are going to somehow resupply the 2,000 or so ships that are currently trapped. And the Iranians aren't going to do anything about that to stop it. Well, we'll see.
Yeah, and it, you know, it brings into focus, doesn't it, something we don't necessarily focus on enough, which is the plight of the seamen and probably seawomen as well, one or two in the mix, on board these commercial ships. These are not military ships.
No, they're not. They are people from all over the world, primarily, well, not primarily, but there's a lot of Sri Lankans and Indians, Pakistanis, people from across the globe. And this is not their fight. And what is it, 10 weeks now, trapped on these ships, dwindling supplies. Some of them will probably have medical needs. And as I said, there's about 20,000 of them. So that is a humanitarian issue. Perhaps some of the shipping. I mean, the problem with if you could helicopter some of them off, if they were close to some of the shorelines on the Arab side of the Persian Gulf, but ships need crews, even if they're just anchored in the middle there waiting. And who wants to go and replace them? Not that very many. You know, who's going to volunteer for another 10 weeks without being able to get off and being resupplied? So you can understand why somebody is going to try and do it. But the Iranians are still insisting that they are the ones that control both Strait of Hormuz and the Persian Gulf in general. And therefore, if the United States does try to implement this Project Freedom, this humanitarian gesture, as Trump called it, they, as I said, they may have something to say about it. So also, this plan, Shayla, there is no plan. There's just been a sort of paragraph, and that's not a plan. There's nothing about whether they're going to escort ships. There's nothing about how they're going to do it. And if you haven't got a plan that is made public, which insurance company is going to insure a ship to come out through that narrow gap just on a paragraph written at whatever o'clock it was in the morning when Mr. Trump put it out on his Truth Social?
Sorry,
go on.
I was going